very much. So with that, I'd like to officially welcome everyone to today's Clue and Internet Seminar, which is part of the Military Munitions Support Services Internet Seminar Workshop Series that's being hosted over the next few months by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Today's seminar will focus on technology. We'll be joined by a number of speakers on that topic today. My name is Jean Balance. I'll be serving as one of your online moderators for today's session. And before we begin the technical portion of the broadcast, I'm going to go ahead and cover a couple of housekeeping and reminder items. If you haven't done so already, I'm going to encourage you to try to join us online for the interactive broadcast. I'd refer you back to your registration emails or registration reminder emails that you would have received from me that had important information on how to join us today. They would have referenced you to something called the seminar homepage, where you can find the complete agenda for today's session, contact information for our speakers and moderators, copies of the PowerPoint or PDF materials that our speakers will be going through. And there's also a very important Go to Seminar button that if you click on it in the upper left corner, you'll be asked to identify yourself and you can actually join us online for the interactive Adobe Connect broadcast. Again, if you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, you'll find that available to download at the top as well as the bottom of the seminar homepage. Our entire session today is going to be offered online through Adobe Connect, so you'll be able to watch our presenters as they give their talks in real time from remote locations. The entire broadcast, again, will also be streamed online, so you can actually listen to that audio by default right through your computer or mobile device. If you're having any problems with the online broadcast, you can also download that PDF copy and simply follow along on the phone line. But we encourage you to try to join us for that online broadcast to get the full interactive experience. If you have problems with the online audio, please feel free to go ahead and report that in the Q&A window in the lower right corner. The first thing I'm going to ask that you do if you do have online audio problems is to go ahead and check your local volume settings. Sometimes you simply need to turn the speakers up or go into your sound control panel and increase your speaker output. Other participants have reported that simply using a pair of headphones can help with that online audio. If that doesn't solve the problem, simply type up a message in the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen, and I'll be happy to share a toll-free call information for anyone who needs it. A gentle reminder to our presenters today, if you're not actively speaking, we would ask that you keep your phone lines muted to help cut down on the audio background. All participants, though, have already been muted and will remain on mute for the entire broadcast today. I've referenced that Q&A window, and you're going to use that as attendees to submit your comments and questions for today's broadcast. Again, in the lower right corner, you can type up a comment, question, or report a technical problem at any time. It's a private forum, so only I and the other moderators will read your comments, and we'll either respond directly to you, or we'll save them up in our queue until we get to the live Q&A periods with our speakers, and then ask them out loud on your behalf. Again, today's entire broadcast is going to be recorded, and you will automatically will receive an email from me as soon as that archive is available for free replay. The other two seminars in the series have already been posted and archived on the CLUIN website, and you're certainly welcome to browse our nearly 500 archived seminars. Again, that URL is shown at the bottom of slide number 3. If you're having any problems with the online audio, you might want to close out of the broadcast or simply and then rejoin the meeting. And also, if you're joining us from a public Wi-Fi hotspot, we've had some issues that online audio quality may degrade there. If you need it, I'll simply give you a telephone call-in number so you can join us from your location. Just a gentle reminder, when you come into the online broadcast, you're going to see the presentations in the majority of your screen sort of changing dynamically as we go through our talks. If you have problems viewing, there's a full screen button in the upper right corner. You can click on that at any time to temporarily enlarge the size of the slides. And if you press it again, that'll turn it off and bring you back into the normal view. You'll find a series of interactive windows or pods to the right side of your screen, including some related URLs. You can click on those at any time and actually press the Browse To button to open those up locally on your computer. If you're watching the recorded version, those links will still work for you. And then in the lower right corner, you'll find the Import Q&A window with a welcome message from me in there. You can type up your own comments, questions, and into this box at the very bottom, and then press the little cartoon bubble to the right to submit your comment or question at any time. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's session, so I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to Dwayne Ford to continue on with moderating. Dwayne?
Very good. Thanks, Jean. Happy Earth Day to everyone, and welcome to the third session of the Military Munitions Support Services webinar series. Jean's gone over most of the instructions and administrative announcements, and probably a lot of y'all have already participated in the previous webinars, so I'm not going to repeat that material, and we'll get this Highwire Act underway. Big shout out to EPA's CLUIN staff, especially Jean, for their assistance and support in helping us conduct these webinars, and an even bigger shout out to the audience for taking time to join us for today's session. The theme for this month's webinar is technology, and I picked this quote from Mark Twain to open our session because I've worked on munitions projects for over a decade, and during that time I've had the pleasure of working with a number of cranks. But I think I'm on the cusp of having to begrudgingly grant non-crank status to some of these folks. As you'll see from today's session, some of these new ideas are really starting to come to fruition. Another quote that I started to use for today's session is from Arthur C. Clarke. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. We've got a terrific set of speakers today that I think will help demystify some of the magic for us muggles. And one of the geophysics wizards that I've always relied upon is Mr. Andy Schwartz with EMCX. And Andy's the moderator who crafted today's webinar. So many, many thanks to Andy. And I'm Dwayne Ford. I'll be facilitating today's session, introducing the speakers, and trying to keep us on time. Here's the agenda of what we're going to cover today. Hopefully y'all have already seen this on the clue-in page, the opening page. And again, Gene has covered most of these administrative issues already in preparation for us launching the technical presentations. The one thing that I would like to emphasize is please, 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 I do entreat all of you to help spread the word about these webinars. If you find them beneficial or helpful, useful in any way, please be sure to let your colleagues, your project delivery team members know about and know about these sessions and encourage them to sign up for them. Here's some of the remaining M2SU webinars, the ones that we have scheduled for this year. If one of these is in your wheelhouse, registration is open, so please go right ahead and sign up. And as Gene mentioned, we've taken the liberty of DVRing these sessions for you. So if you missed an episode or if you just want to replay some of the really exciting parts, well, they're available for you to view at your leisure. And then this is my shameless pandering slide. We're hoping to schedule new M2SU webinars as long as we have topics and speakers and an audience. But to do that, we need your help. If you've got an idea for a topic or know of a good subject matter expert speaker, please let me know. You know, this is a great opportunity to showcase your particular expertise, gain some visibility with your colleagues, and just improve our industry in general. So please hurry. Operators are standing by. And then, you know, you've seen this before. You'll see it again. This is our 3 R's of explosive safety. I want you all of you to please continue to hammer home the 3 R's message to the communities and stakeholders that you work with. And with that, I'm going to turn it over very briefly to Andy. Andy, you have a few words you want to say to talk about today's episode?
Yes, I do, Dwayne. Thank you very much. First, I'd like to thank everyone for dialing in today and listening to this webinar. I'd also like to thank my speakers who have taken the time out of their very busy schedules to help put this together. Also, I'd like to thank Dwayne and everyone else behind the scenes, and Gene. There's a small army that helped put this session together that aren't on any of the slides, but I'd like to give them a little recognition. And lastly, I'd like to thank Ms. Sullivan who elected to cancel a trip to Australia so that she could come and speak to us in just a few minutes. I'd like to really quickly explain how this agenda came about. It really, this technology, we're going to be focusing on advanced classification. We have learned in the last several years that this technology is a very important tool in our munitions response toolbox, and it is well into its technology transition phase. So the purpose of this session is to first explain the importance of this technology, its importance to DoD, then to explain what the technology is and where it is headed, and then last, we'll close with three very different aspects of how it's being used today. And with that very brief outline, I'll turn it back over to Dwayne. Thank you, Dwayne.
Okay. Thanks, Andy. Well, our first speaker is Maureen Sullivan, and Ms. Sullivan is with the Office of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, Installations and Environment, where she is the Director of Environment, Safety, and Occupational Health. We are very fortunate to have a slice of Ms. Sullivan's day. So, Ms. Sullivan, please lead it off for us.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. My introduction is to introduce myself, but thank you. I don't need to do that. Here's what I'm going to talk about today, and I'm going to try and move this through rapidly so that we can get to questions. Sorry, So everybody always wants to know what's going on with the budget. So here's my synopsis of the budget. You know, we're in very uncertain times. We're working under a continuing resolution for the entire year. We're struggling with sequestration. As you see, the FY13 numbers are what we requested in the president's budget. We don't know what the final numbers will be yet because of all the puts and takes. I can tell you that Congress directed us to spend an additional $50 million in the FUDS program. That is in the bill, but it is going to be subject to the sequestration cuts. And then you'll notice that the FY14 request is about 120 or so million less than 13, and most of those cuts are in the area of site investigations and analysis, both for the Army and the Air Force. And I think that's a strong indicator of where we are in the program. We're reaching the completion of those phases for our known sites. For BRAC, it's a similar story. As you can see, again, we did, in fact, get the columns are reversed there. So I apologize for that. This is the request, and this is the congressional action. So in typical fashion, we got an additional $60 million for legacy BRAC, which we will dutifully spend in California. Again, the reduction in the 14 request is along the same lines. It's less money for site investigation analysis, again, indicator of where we are in the maturity of the program. So, we're still waiting the final 13 numbers, as I mentioned. We know they're coming, but we want to develop some strategies so that we have the least amount of impact on the program and focusing on actions and investments on protecting human health and the environment. We've asked all the components to look at their progress and think about what they can do to maintain their program's progress with the less funding that we are actually going to get. Our priority is to continue to meet federal facility agreement requirements and other legal commitments, maintaining remedial action operations, maintaining long-term monitoring. But at the end, we're going to have less money, so some of the schedules are going to slip. What we're hoping is no new starts, maybe, is my phrase, but it's more likely to be fewer studies. We're going to have to delay that. Another complicating factor is getting this money so late in the year. We still have the requirement to obligate 80% by July. So this is going to be a tough workload for us to get all that money obligated in that short period of time, and that may add some complications. But ultimately, the key to success here is going to be all of our folks, the DoD folks, Army, Navy, Air Force, on the ground handling these cuts, working on these issues in partnership with the regulators and the community. So it is open and transparent of how we're prioritizing our work. So let me talk to you a little bit about the size of the program. Many of you probably already know all of this. The department has about 39,000 sites, as you can see. About a little less than 5,000 of those are munitions response sites. We calculate our, quote, liability, which is the cost to complete the rest of the work that's sitting out there. By the way, the liability for all of our cleanup is the second largest liability in the entire Department of Defense. Number one is military benefits, and we're a long way from that, but we are number two. Now, of the remaining liability, as you can see, almost half of it is in the munitions response. Now, 34,000 sites versus 5,000 sites, with half of it being in those 5,000 sites. And of that, most of it, $9.9 billion, is in the FUDS program, the Formerly Used Defense Program. Now, generally, one of the things we like to use is land use controls. But FUDS, we don't own the property, so land use controls are really not an option on privately owned sites. So we need to look at that, the risk associated at these sites as part of our process. And of course, as many of you know, the states are pushing us to get to those sites as soon as possible. Now, we still have liabilities on our active bases. We can do land use controls on our active bases. However, that's not a long-term solution because it encumbers the land. We can't use it for another purpose, such as, I don't know, training. That's a priority for us. So some of you probably have heard about our new DERP goals. Let me walk through you how we got here. We just finished a very thorough review and analysis of our goals. And if you're familiar with the history of the program, we had 18 separate goals that we were tracking, which is just mind-boggling. And they were various steps along the way, and they were created many years ago. So, and they didn't reflect how mature the program was right now. So we stepped back and we consolidated everything down to four goals that you see on the slide there. And we're focusing on the end of the program, achieving response complete. The other thing I want to highlight in looking at these goals, there are not separate goals for munitions response sites and IRP sites, except for FUDS. I'll talk about FUDS. So by merging these, there's no more, I need to finish my IRP sites and then I can move to my MMRP sites. No more of that. That's all gone. It's all consolidated down. We actually do have a fifth goal that I want to highlight for you. We also have an evaluation pending goal in the munitions response program to eliminate those sites that haven't gone through the prioritization protocol. We have a backlog in this category, and we want to get them done so that we can actually put them in the queue to get cleaned up and on the path forward. With consolidated goals, they're consistent with our levels of investment so far, and of course, they're pushing us to get towards response complete. Now, we have not established a FUDS MMRP goal yet. We're continuing work with the Army team, including the Corps of Engineers folks, to develop goal. Ultimately, the goal must be aggressive, but it must be realistic and achievable within the funding levels that we have now. I just want to highlight this very quickly. This is our progress chart. People wonder how we're doing. Well, out of our sites right now, 77% of the sites are at response complete. Response complete. That's huge. That's really, really telling us we've done the vast bulk of our work. So what's left are the highly complicated IRP sites and these munition response sites, and that's where we have to concentrate the rest of our program from here on. We're on track to meet the FY18 goal for 90% of the sites at response complete, and we're on track for the 95%. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that we can maintain that projection. So there are always a lot of questions about the future of the munitions response program. When will we be done? How much will it cost? How long will DoD leave the risks uncontrolled? I'm a strong believer that the classification technology is a key to the future of the munitions program. It will reduce individual site cleanup costs and allow us to do more with the funds we have available. The technology will enhance our overall effectiveness, improve safety for response personnel, increase the overall protection of human health and the environment, reduce the cost to complete, and ultimately increase the program efficiency. Now, following me, Herb Nelson's going to talk, and he's going to about the demonstration project, so I will leave all that technical to him, but I just want to convey how important this is to us. So Herb's going to talk about where we are in the demonstration. So it's now time for us to really, really start thinking about how do we transition from demonstration to this becoming the way forward. I've broken it into five big areas of activities that we need to work on. And I want to walk through each one of them very quickly with you. First, we need an educated workforce. That means everybody that's involved in the program, whether it's the DoD folks, the EPA, states, contractors, the communities, they have to understand what this means, what the technology means, how it can be used, how it will translate to their sites on the ground. We got to do some work on updating policies and procedures, getting some education out there, developing tools and guidance. So you have an educated workforce. Well, the next thing is, do you have good data to make an informed decision? Ultimately, what we're trying to do is come to an agreement between all of us that this is the data set. Try to avoid the concept of bring me a rock. So one of the keys to that would be developing a uniform federal policy on quality and assurance project plans, or as the people in that world call it, the UFP QAP. What an acronym. That document, there is one for IRP sites that is jointly signed by DoD and EPA. We would like a similar document for munitions response sites, jointly signed by DoD and EPA, and we would really like the states to sign on to that. All right, so we have an educated workforce. We have good data. Then the next thing is, what goes in the decision document or ROD? What do these documents look like? Because ultimately, that's going to drive the work on the ground. So I have lots of questions here. We need to look at what works, what doesn't work. How do the stakeholders play in this? Should there be set language, or should there be criteria? Ultimately, are we writing these decision documents in a way that enables us to use the latest technologies to incentivize creative solutions as we move forward? So, all right. So now we have, step back. So one of the other things in the decision document is, what are we going to leave in the ground? That has to be part of that process. So now we have an educated workforce, we have good data, we have a solid decision document abroad, but now the rubber meets the road where we have to have a strong statement of work. We need to come to an agreement up front of what we're asking the contractor to do. We need to step back and look at how we're writing these contracts now, these statements of work now. Are we writing them in a way that prevents adoption of the technology? How do we write them in a way to motivate consideration and ultimate adoption of the technology? Need some work there. We'll need to look at what's good, what's bad. But ultimately, both for the decision document and the statement of work, we have to understand up front, how are we measuring and demonstrating success? because we have to be able to demonstrate that we performed what was laid out in the decision document, and we also have to have a way to measure the contractor's performance. Did he or she achieve the goals that we set forward? I would contend that's not exactly clear always, and I think we need to do some work there. And it's important to define that up front so everybody agrees up front. It's not a guessing game. So those are my basic five big areas. There are other things that also fall in there, such as land use controls, transparency, how do we work with RABs, but I think once you get through these five fundamental areas, it's easy to address those other topics. So let me talk a little bit about partnerships. Because ultimately, it's going to be, this is all done in partnership. We don't do this in a vacuum. One of the partnerships I'm most excited to update you about today is the Munitions Response Dialogue. And, of course, we have an acronym, the MRD. Some of you may have been familiar with the state-led Munitions Response Forum, or the SMRF. EPA established that back in 2009 to bring together EPA state regulators and federal land managers, including DOD, to discuss and resolve some cleanup problems associated with munitions response sites. The SMRF did some great work on interim risk, collaborative decision-making, underwater munitions, and emergency response. And it was a good opportunity for people to come together and talk about what's going on and for us to use that group as a sounding board for our future directions. Where are we going? Unfortunately, EPA funding for this initiative ran out. So we so strongly believe that this is so important to us that we figured out how to actually finance it, and DOD is financing it now. We've got all the membership agreed to. We have the general rules of the road agreed to, and it looks like we're going to have our first meeting in the June or July timeframe. And I'm pretty excited about that. It's been a long road to figure out how to do this in context with the FACA, the Federal Advisory Committee Act, to make sure we're staying within the rules. So it's very scripted in terms of who, what, when, where, and how in order to avoid the FACA rules. But it'll be a great advance. So overall, just in conclusion, you see my concluding points up there. I'm a firm believer that this is the future of the munitions response program, and its ultimate success is going to be when we all work together to get it done. It will help us get to sites faster, address the risk factor, and ensure that we're protecting human health and the environment. And I look forward to everybody being part of that solution set. So thank you, and I'm not sure if we have time for questions.
Ms. Oldham, this is Dwayne. I think that we probably have time for maybe one question before we kick off our next speaker. We had one question came in was, do you foresee the installation restoration program funds and the active components budgets being transitioned to FUDs as they meet their closeout goals?
No. That's an easy one. No. What happens is that they are actually in the top line for each of the military departments. So I do not foresee that happening, maybe in the Army, but we haven't even thought about that yet.
Okay. Excellent. Very good. Well, Ms. Sullivan, I'll tell you, I really, really appreciate it. Excellent information. We very much appreciate the strategic perspective on both the munitions response work that we do and then also upon the advanced classification technologies. We very much appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Sure. Our next speaker is Dr. Herb Nelson, and Herb is the program manager for munitions response at the Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program, commonly known as SERDEP, and the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program, ESTCP. Herb's a pretty regular contributor. He is excellent about sharing his expertise, his knowledge, what we've learned, and trying to improve our efforts along the advanced classification. So once again, we are very, very welcoming of Herb. Herb, let's get started with you.
Okay, thank you, Dwayne. So as Ms. Sullivan made reference to a few minutes ago, my primary goal here is to talk about and bring you all up to date on the progress in our ESCCP demonstration program, where we're demonstrating classification on live sites. But before I do that, as you'll see here on the outline, I'm going to spend a little time talking about the technology that makes up classification, both the sensors and how we do the analysis. And I'm going to do that for two reasons. Number one, of course, I want to make sure that everybody in the audience is on the same page, and we all know what I'm talking about when I get to the second part of the talk. But the other reason I'm doing this is I'm going to serve as a lead-in for all the presenters that follow me in today's session. So you're going to have to take your background medicine once from me, but you only have to take it once. You don't have to hear it every time. So let's just get going with that medicine right now. So there are really three stages in the classification process. Go out and take some data using an advanced instrument over a buried metal object cued to you by an anomaly in some sort of geophysical survey. Use those data to extract some features or parameters about the target, something to do with its size or its shape or something like that. And then use those parameters to make a decision on the target. And we call it classification because we're going to classify these things as either targets of interest or not. So let's just step through these one by one. The sensors that we use in classification are electromagnetic induction sensors. Those of you that have been on munitions response sites, and I assume most of you on this webinar have seen an EM61 probably out there, the orange rectangular sensor that people pull around. That's a relatively simple electromagnetic induction sensor, but this is how those things work. Number one, we put a pulse of current through a transmit coil. That's inside that orange thing you see on an EM61. That sets up a magnetic field in the nearby soil. If there happens to be a metal object buried underneath the sensor, or of course sitting on the surface below the sensor, then that target is magnetized. And then when we shut off the current in the transmit coil, some currents are set up inside the buried target that result in a field, a secondary field, or induced field sometimes it's called, and then that field is sensed by another coil, which is the receive coil. So we have a transmit coil and a receive coil. And as we look in time, this little thing that just popped up on the bottom right of the slide, the magnitude of that field or the magnitude of the currents or the voltage we measure in that coil falls off with time, something on the order of milliseconds. So we need relatively advanced electronics to look at this thing. Now, everything I've showed you today, there's absolutely nothing new about this. I got my 1965 version of Grant and West, a classic textbook on this, out the other day, and it's got the analytic solutions for this for a spherical target. So none of this has occurred in pretty much my lifetime. But we've done a lot of R&D on this subject in the last 10 or 15 years, shown here on the slide. Really, the big development is this BUD. And what's big about that, BUD stands for Berkeley UXO Discriminator. What's big about that project was these workers started with a blank page. We didn't use a sensor designed in the 70s and 80s, the EM61, and we didn't use a sensor that was designed to find underground storage tanks. They started with a blank page and designed a sensor for detecting and classifying UXO. And once that project was a success, you can see in the timeline lots of other things that flowed from it, including this live site demonstration program that I'm talking to you about today. So I'm going to show you one particular flaw that we have using a single axis sensor, which is this EM61 we've talked about a couple of times. And you'll see here that I've drawn the sensor to be more rectangular to look like the one you've seen in the field. And that is that the field lines only are in one direction relative to the sensor. So you can see when you're in front of a buried metal object, you're interrogating in one orientation, or one aspect of it. If you move the sensor right over the top, the field lines intersect at another angle. And if you continue going down the walking down a line, now you're interrogating almost on the long axis. So we have to piece together 2 or 3 or 5 or 15 measurements over a sensor to completely interrogate, over a target, excuse me, to completely interrogate that target. That works great in a parking lot, but it doesn't work so well in the field because the sensor's bouncing, the GPS antenna on the top of it's bouncing and rocking and swaying as you walk. So it's very tough to know where you were precisely for each of those measurements. So the advantages of a multi-axis sensor are shown in this little animation that's on the next slide. Here's a sensor made up of 3 coils. If we pulse those coils sequentially from one spot, you can see we get fields set up that interrogate the short axis, another short axis, and then finally the long axis of this target, a little slower than I can speak. And so you can see from one measurement with a multi-axis sensor, we can interrogate all 3 axes of the target. Therefore, we don't have to piece together measurements, and we don't have to rely on this point-to-point sampling. So that's certainly the future of these advanced sensors. They're all multi-axis sensors compared to a single-axis sensor, the M61. So here's an example of some of the ones that have been developed under CERTIP and ESDCP sponsorship. On the first page here, we have the relatively large vehicular tow system. People have seen the TEMTAD sometimes. Let me point here. So people have seen this TEMTADs and or the metal mapper. Down there, the metal mapper, up here, the TEMTADs. There's also smaller versions of those things. Here's something called the man-portable vector sensor. That's really carried by a fellow on the end of a rod. Here's a portable bud, the smaller version of the TEMTADs, shown at the bottom of these. So depending on the terrain, depending on whether you need, whether it's amenable to vehicular towing or you need a cart or person carried, we've got advanced sensors that solve all of those issues. Sorry, my slide didn't advance there. So sort of summing up the sensors, here's the positive and the negative things about EMI sensors and the signals that come out of them. The positive part, of course, at the top in the bullet that's marked with a plus sign is the EMI response that we measure is determined by the size and the shape of the target, the wall thickness, the material, meaning steel versus aluminum, something like that, of the target. So that's all the things we want to know to be able to classify a target as something we're interested in or something we're not. Unfortunately, the negative bullet shows us that this response is muddled by how we are relative to how we are positioned relative to the target, how the target is buried in the ground, if we're in front of it and we're back of it. And I showed you that in the individual, in that single sensor thing 4 or 5 slides ago. So what we've got to do is figure out a way to extract the stuff that we want at the top of the target, the information we want in this top bullet, which we will use for classification, and separate out this target location and orientation, which we will use when we go back to try to intrusively investigate the target. So that is done in the second stage of classification, in which we say we extract target features or we extract target parameters, and those parameters are all those things that are on the last slide: size, shape, materials properties, symmetric or not. Those are the kind of things that we will recover, and we do this through a process called data inversion, which is a geophysicist word, and what that really means is we match it to a model. We match the observed data to a model of the EMI response of metal objects. We vary the parameters of the model till we get a match, and then we call those the parameters of the target. So as I've talked to you about these things, we have multi-axis sensors with a lot of receivers. Here's one of the simpler ones. This is this 2x2 TEMTADs, but you can see even from that one, we get 4x4x3, so that's a big number, 1648, different decays that we measure. These are plotted on the left side of the slide. On the right side of the slide, I show you that I've got a little pipe section mounted right underneath the sensor. If we move that pipe around, you can see that these decays move. If we tip the pipe on its side, the decays change separately. So this is just an indication that we can't really make anything out of these decays because they're all moving around based on position and orientation. But if you've been looking in the bottom right-hand corner of the slide, you've seen that these intrinsic parameters, which we're going to talk about in just a minute, have really not changed at all. So those are the things, these so-called polarizability decay curves. Andy Schwartz refers to them a lot as EMI fingerprints. These are the fundamental properties that we want to extract, and that's how we're going to make our decisions. So I just said all of this as I finished the last slide. These are intrinsic polarizabilities of the target. They're, we derive them along the principal axis directions, and this is the properties of the targets that we're going to use to make a decision. So on the left side of this slide is a 37-millimeter projectile. You can see there are actually three polarizabilities plotted on this, a relatively large one, the one plotted in red, which corresponds to the long axis of the response to the long axis of the target, and then two smaller ones plotted in blue and green that correspond to the two short axes of the target, both up and down and in and out of the board. And you can see, of course, the blue and the green are equal because this is a completely symmetric target. Okay, on the other side of this slide is a just random piece of frag. And if we've been sort of, everything's worked out, and of course it has here, you can see that there are three completely independent curves because there's no symmetry at all in this target. So pretty easy to say here, munition or something we have to treat like a munition, frag, something we don't have to worry about. Now these things, of course, I've shown you here, they depend on symmetry, they depend on wall thickness, that's how fast, how quickly the things fall off is wall thickness. They also depend on size. Here's an example of the EMI fingerprints or EMI responses or polarizability decay curves of a 75-millimeter projectile and a 37-millimeter projectile. You can see they look a lot alike. They just scale in amplitude, and in fact, they scale bumped in like a factor of 10 or 8 or something, which is about how big a 75 is in volume compared to a 37. So this concept of getting the size of the object or getting the relative size of the object from these decay curves will come up in John Jackson's talk later on. Okay, so we're making a lot of progress here. We've extracted these features. Now all we've got to do is use those features to classify ourselves as ourselves or the buried metal object is either a target of interest or not. And really, we only want to do, just like I said, two buckets. We want to put something in the bucket of target of interest or not target of interest. So there's really three ways you can get yourself into the target of interest. Number one way is the most obvious here. We derive the polarizability decay curves, the EMI fingerprints for the unknown target, which are here in the dotted lines, and we compare it to a munition in the library. You can see in this case it's almost an exact match. So we know that this item is a 75-millimeter projectile. These are data from the buried target data from Spencer Range, one of our demonstrations, and you can see this is a bang on 75, so this is clearly a UXO. The other way you can get yourself categorized as a UXO, or as a target of interest, is illustrated on the next slide. Here, this is from our Camp Beale demonstration. There were 25, it turns out. I'm only showing you six of them here, because space on the slide, but there were 25 of these things that gave the exact same set of curves. You can see these are all a little noisy at the end, but these are all the same set of curves. So these were not in our library, but of course if you're characterizing this site, we have to go find out what these are. We dug one of them up, and it turns out it is this little T-bar fuse. So that can either become a target of interest if they're dangerous or not. In this case, they had all functioned and were not dangerous, so they weren't called targets of interest. And then finally, you get to be called a target of interest if you're big and symmetric. This is these are data from our Camp San Luis Obispo demonstration. This item turned out to be, as it says on the bottom of the slide, a 3-inch Stokes, but nobody had that item in their library, so they didn't get a positive library match on this. But of course, we would be not very wise if we left a site without digging up something as big and symmetric as this. And of course, in this case, it turned out to be a 3-inch Stokes. So correspondingly, how do you get yourself classified as clutter? Well, we've already talked it through, but I'm going to give you two ways. Number one, this is the same piece of clutter that we saw earlier. You really have no obvious symmetry. You're clearly a bent up, mangled up piece of metal, and that's what this is. Or number two, you're something we recognize as clutter. These data on the right are from our Pole Mountain demonstration. It's a site that was used for cavalry early in the century. I guess probably even late last century. Late two centuries ago, really, now. And there are a lot of horseshoes on this site. You might notice that when you look at these polarizability decay curves, there's two relatively big and equal ones and one small one. That's really the hallmark of a flat plate, if you think about it. It's big in two axes. It's big in both this axis and this axis, and it's skinny in the axis coming in and out of the board. So this is a plate-like signature, which, of course, after a while at this site, we come to recognize as a horseshoe. So unless you're in the business of digging up horseshoes, this is pretty obviously a clutter item. Okay, so that's the background for this, and now I'll talk in the remaining 7 or 8 minutes of my presentation about our classification demonstration program. So you can see on all the bullets here, there's a lot of words. You don't have to read them all, but we clearly want to validate these technologies. We want to do it at a lot of sites, so we measure munitions types variation. We measure site condition variation. We started this thing 4 or 5 years ago at very, very easy conditions, and we're trying to work ourselves to very, very difficult conditions. Of course, it would be nice if it worked everywhere, but once we find out it's not working, that'll be good. We'll know where the boundaries are. And in the bottom bullet, I think is one of the most important things. We want to engage all stakeholders, regulators, site managers. We want to engage industry, property owners in this process. There's no black box here at all. So we absolutely want everybody to know what's going on and see how well this works. So here is a quick map of the United States and where we've done this thing. You can see that some of them are completed and underway. Some of them are planned. But by the end of this year, we'll have covered a lot of the United States. And then we still have a year and a half left in this program to sort of do some final actions before we get out of here and turn this over to the market. So here's how we go about doing these demos. Obviously, the first bullet is pretty straightforward, and we find someplace to do it. We always seed the site for process validation. I think this will be a huge part of the acceptance of this technology. We're going to ask people to leave pieces of metal in the ground that we say are not munitions. We always put a lot of surrogates and inert munitions out so that we prove every day that this process of identifying correctly the munitions is working. Right now, we do this in a two-step process. We do a geophysical survey to identify anomalies, and then we go back and sit on those anomalies with the advanced sensors and collect some extra data. That's how the series of slides in the beginning I showed you was carried out. Tom Bell, in the next talk after me, is going to explain to you what great success we're having in the last demo or two, making this a one-step process, and he'll give you some idea of how quickly we can expect that to become more widespread. And then I walked you through this, but now we just do it. We have a series of data sets. We go through and extract principal axis polarizabilities from those. We decide which ones are targets of interest, which ones are not. In a real munitions cleanup, of course, we'd only dig the things that were hazardous, but we're doing experiments, so we dig them all, and that's how we grade the demonstrators. So we ask our demonstrators to turn in a ranked anomaly list. It looks a lot like this one on slide 29. There's always a couple, looking at the left side of this slide now, there's always a couple where something went wrong. The battery ran down, you didn't pay attention, or the GPS glitched or something. Those you can't tell anything about, so we have to presume that they are targets of interest, and we dig those always. We also dig all of those targets that we know are targets of interest. And I showed you a perfect example of that, that 75, where the data is bang on, matches the 75 library. We hope, of course, that the green area at the bottom is by far the biggest. And those are things that are either clutter or we recognize them as a piece of barbed wire or baling wire or horseshoe or fin. And then sometimes in the first pass, there are some things in the middle that we just can't decide on and we might want to sample a little to make a decision. Ultimately, though, we have to have a ranked anomaly list that looks like the right side of this slide. We have to make a decision, dig or don't dig on every item. So here's how we... present the results of these things. Ms. Sullivan made me earlier when she said disparagingly, bring me a rock. And I didn't know whether she meant this rock, my receiver operating characteristic curve, but fortunately on her second to last slide, I found out she meant an actual rock. So we use these so-called receiver operating characteristics curves, which really came from radar analysis in the 40s and 30s and 50s. And the way you go about these things is you dig down this list, starting at the top item, digging down to the bottom. If you get a munition or target of interest, you go up. If you get a piece of clutter, you go to the right. So here is a perfect curve where everything that we called a munition was a munition, and everything we called clutter was clutter. And so this is the, obviously, in a perfect world, this is what we want to look like. Here's the absolute worst you can do. This is just total chance. You can see that the items that you called munitions had some chance of being a munition because they went up some, but they also had a big chance of being clutter. But that's exactly the same chance as did the items that you called clutter. So you're really only flipping a coin here. You have no predictive capability. So to the extent that you look like this, it's good. And the extent you look like this, it's terrible and you should be fired. So as you can imagine, I've got hundreds of these plots from all the demonstrations we've done, and I could take the entire rest of the day flipping through them. But all I'm going to do is show you one example. This is from our recent Spencer Range demonstration. This is a production contractor, first time they've ever attempted this process, straight out of the box. And although it's not, it doesn't match the perfect curve, it's pretty darn close. The stuff that was called munitions, particularly in the beginning, goes straight up just like you'd want it to see. There's a little bit of uncertainty in here where some things that are actually caught were called munitions. But you'll notice the demonstrator marks the threshold where they think they've gotten every hazardous item off the site, and there's that little threshold, and they're right. And then I later on put the orange dot, which is the last munition that was identified, and sure enough, they were slightly conservative in their threshold. This is extremely good performance. And the most important part of this is from here to here, which, I don't know, looks like at least three quarters to me, are correctly identified clutter items that could be left in the ground. So let me repeat as I get off at a slide. This was not one of our experts. This is not one of our developers. It's a first-time production contractor. So I think these techniques are accessible to everybody. So this is a little bit of a cryptic slide, and I don't know whether it's going to work, but it's the point of this is to show you that in just a couple of years, how much improvement we've seen in this process. The left half of each of these pair is the probability of cut classification at the analyst threshold. The one I just showed you before had, of course, at the analyst threshold, they had 100% correct classification. So on the left side of each pair, which is here and here, up is good. The right side of each pair is the number of clutter items that were required to be dug, so down is good. So you can see that from 10 to 12, the intermediates and experts have really improved their performance, and they've really narrowed the band. They've gotten a lot more alike and a lot better. The novices, of course, have not really changed, and the reason for that is because it's new novices every time. So as people move from the novice to intermediate to expert category, their performance really improves. Okay, so I'm about running out of time here, so let's just get on to the end of this. Here are some of the conclusions that we're developing. We've been successful at a wide variety of sites, both using vehicle towed and portable sensors. We've worked at sites that had munitions as small as 37s and done extremely well. We are working on 20-millimeter sites this year, so we'll see how it is. That's going to be obviously a tough challenge. Metal Mapper has good depth performance, small portable sensors, a little more limited. Tom's going to talk about some of that in the next line. We work on pretty high anomaly densities, maybe even a little higher than is shown on this slide. And as I showed you just a minute ago, there's clearly a learning curve for analysts. So summing up here, we've got, if we did a 100-acre site, currently, of course, we dig a lot of stuff, and most of it's clutter. So you can see that most of the money goes to digging clutter. If we can achieve a 75% reduction in this clutter to be dug, then we shrink the total amount of money that's required for the site, of course, as the whole pie shrinks. But we also spend a lot more of our money collecting queue data and a lot less digging clutter. And if we can do a dynamic survey using the advanced sensors, as Tom's going to talk about in a minute, using that same clutter reduction, we cut down, of course, the queue data because we don't have to use so much queue data, and we make the pie even smaller. So prospects look really good, I think, for achieving Ms. Sullivan's aim of really putting this into practice and using it to save a lot of money. So I'll finish up with our website. Couple of places you might go when you get there. You can get information about everything I didn't talk about and anything else you might want to know. So I thank you all for your attention, and Dwayne, back to you.
Pretty good, Herb, as always. Excellent, excellent presentation. Good delivery. Heck, you even made it where I could understand it, which is quite the feat. We have time for a few questions, and we have had a few questions that came in from the audience. First one was, I know the Metal Mapper is commercially available. When can we expect to have the handheld and manned portable sensors available for use?
Well, I would say this TimTeds 2x2 would probably be a year or so. There are now five of those. Dan Steinhurst from the Naval Research Lab is in Vieques today, actually delivering two to NAVFAC, who's bought some for use out of Vieques. As Geometrics is working to modernize and update the Metal Mapper program, they're making all of their components, the electronics, the data acquisition, everything, support both of those sensors. So I think year-ish, one will be able to order one of those from Geometrics.
Okay, very good. Not yet quite available down at the Walmart.
That's right.
Okay.
But then, heck, everybody will be in the business once you get them at the Walmart. We want to get in quick when they're not.
That's right. Next question. What happens after the demonstration period?
Our demonstration program, yes. We hope that this baby is born and walking and it's out to the market, huh? I think we expect it. Certainly, if current performance extrapolates into the next 2 years, that we'll have demonstrated the situations where this is makes sense and where it doesn't make sense. I mean, there's clearly places this is not going to make sense. If you have to dig everything anyway, why would you want us, huh? But we hope that there'll be good understanding of the process by industry, government, and regulators, and the market will take over.
Okay, very good. Next question, when do you think the regulators will agree to the results? Have you heard any feedback on that?
I think we hear relatively positive feedback on that from regulators in states that are relatively sophisticated. If you don't really know anything about munitions response, and there are certainly states where the regulators fit in that category, you're going to be pretty dubious about this. But we've had good luck with the regulators from some of the states like California and Colorado who can understand the process and are starting to, have been involved with us and understand its limitations and its strong points. Andy Schwartz has been involved along with the Sacramento District and California DTSC in a couple of pilot projects to get the California regulators heavily involved. And so I think those are the kind of things that are going to bring us there.
Okay. That sounds very promising. What was the deepest depth used in these studies?
Well, I think I heard a long time ago when I started doing this data that the Corps in Huntsville said, and maybe John Potter taught me this, that 90% of the things are in the first foot and 95% in the first 2 feet or something like that. We have put seeds deeper than that, but we rarely find existing items deeper than that. So obviously 155s can get deeper in a foot, but a lot of things in a munition site are in that first foot.
Okay. How close do you think the technology is to application for the 20 millimeters?
Well, it's certainly applicable to 20 millimeters. I only have some anecdotal data on that. The NRL guys have played around in their backyard with 20 millimeters, and CH2M Hill actually did a little pilot study for the Navy on Vieques in an area that had 20 millimeters. You clearly, this idea of getting rid of 90% of the clutter is probably not feasible on a 20-millimeter site. You can, as you can imagine, there's a lot of small frag that looks like a 20-millimeter. Those guys would say you may have to give back about a third of the clutter to get the 20-millimeters. So we would like to really get that number firmed up, and then that's a site team decision, huh? It depends on whether you want to get the 20-millimeters off enough to pay for it or not, and each site will be different depending on the anticipated site use how the land use control is going to be implemented. So I just want to get those numbers firmed up.
Got it. Okay, pretty good. I think we have time for one more question, Herb, and then we'll let you off the hook, or at least until the end of the webinar session when we have our open discussion and Q&A. Outside of a demonstration site, and this question may not really be, we may not be quite ready for this, but I'll throw it out there anyway. Outside of a demonstration site, what percentage of unknowns, modeled as clutter items, would be recommended to dig as a QC measure?
Well, that's a tough issue, huh? I think people are really struggling with that. I think maybe the question is not posed quite correctly. It might not be a percentage of the total unknowns. I guess today you will see some talk by John Jackson and later talk about how he might approach it. Let's say a simplified version of John's talk that's coming up after the break is, I talked about three ways to get classified as a target of interest. I think you for sure would want to go test the boundaries that you drew on each of those three ways. So if there were six ways to get classified, you might want to test six boundaries. So that's going to be sort of dependent on the site, the munitions mix. But I don't think numbers should be large, 5, 8, some number percent like that. And you know, we're talking about avoiding 75 or 80% of the dig. So if we go back and dig 5% of those, it doesn't matter a bit. We're still saving a lot of money.
Very good. Well, Herb, once again, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your very good approach at presenting this material. Our next speaker is Mr. Tom Bell, and Tom comes to us from SAIC, and Tom's a physicist by training, but somewhere down the road he added geo to as a preface to that physicist title. And for the past 15 years or so, he's been involved with R&D for UXO remediation, and he's been pretty instrumental in helping develop some of the technologies that we're talking about today. So, Tom, take it away.
Okay, thank you. As Herb mentioned, I'm going to be talking a little bit about where some of this classification technology is moving as we move along. And just to kind of go back a sec, Andy asked me to stick in here a little bit of why we wanted to do this talk right now. And it's because he was back at that Spencer Range demonstration that Herb referred to. And he saw advanced sensors doing both detection and classification and was really very surprised at how well it seemed to work. And he wanted you all to know that he expects that this technology will be moving along and become available sooner rather than later. Exactly what sooner rather than later means, we'll see. What I'm going to be covering here are a brief review of what Herb said about how we currently do classification, and that is doing an EM61 survey and then going back with the advanced sensors, and how we want to move on to do both the initial survey and the classification with the advanced sensor. I'm going to talk specifically about one of them, the 2x2 TIMTADS, how we expect its performance for detection to end up relative to the EM61, and then talk a little bit about what we did with it at the former Spencer Range, and then close up with a summary and where we seem to be headed. This slide here shows the typical workflow for classification at one of the demonstrations, and this is what Herb was talking about. First thing we do is we take an EM61 out and do a geophysical survey, then map the data, pick targets, and then we go back and flag them, either electronically, so that if we have GPS positions, we could go revisit them, or with a physical flag. But in any event, we take our sensor, like shown on the right, go back to the locations, the anomaly locations, put the sensor over them, park the sensor, collect data, take the data back, process it to classify the targets as either munitions or clutter. Now, the problem that we have here is that we use two different sensors for the beginning and the ending stage, and in that queued process, we can get maybe a couple hundred a day, depending on conditions. And those are two areas where we could improve efficiency, either mobilization, demobilization, equipment costs, and then also the overall cost of going back and doing queued. The real issues how rapidly can we do the survey? You know, do we have to take a hit in terms of how long it takes to do the survey? How well can we classify with a moving sensor? And that impacts or that determines how many we have to go back and revisit if we can't classify them all with the moving sensor. Mm-hmm. And then also, are there additional effects of terrain, vegetation, and so forth on our ability to do this? So now I'm going to talk about this one specific sensor, and the top picture is a little shot of it. It's this cart-mounted TEMTADS array. The middle picture shows there's four sensors. One of them has been removed from the tray. This is the white tray that you see on the cart. And the bottom picture shows you what that sensor looks like. There's a big coil, and then inserted in the coil is this little cube, which has three receiver coils. So it's got four transmitter loops, four receivers, each of which looks three axes, and a GPS unit on the top up there to for positioning. I lost my guy over there. There we are. Got the GPS up there. We modify the data acquisition on this, as I mentioned before, with the queued. We park over the target and collect a fair amount of data. We modify it a little bit so we can transmit continuously, pinging from one transmitter to the other. And we can do that 7.5 hertz so that at a reasonable walking speed, you can collect reasonable density of data. The problem is that you get less averaging than you did with the static or queued operation. And the upshot of that is that some targets may still require queued data for classification, weak targets in noisy areas. Now, one of the ways to talk about how well these things detect is using the so-called response curves. And these are two examples. What we've got on the left is the EM61, and on the right, the 2x2 TEM. And what we plot is the signal out of the sensor as a function of depth of the target below ground. All these little dots are individual measurements that were made with the EM61. In this case, it's a 60-millimeter mortar. And the blue line shows the expected response as a function of depth, calculated using the standard models. The dashed line that I've shown down here is sort of a detectability threshold based on the noise levels from that were seen at Spencer Range. And so the first thing you notice here is that the two sets of curves look kind of similar. And in fact, if you look at where the curves drop into that sort of noise level, detection threshold, seems to be about the same, maybe 11 times the diameter of that 60-millimeter mortar. So this is positive. It says that, you know, perhaps this sensor should, in fact, perform similar to the EM61. Now, what I'm going to do now is talk about what we actually did at Spencer Range. And here, the picture shows the 2x2 at Spencer. You see the GPS antenna up there. This was done just last year. They had a variety of munitions items and pipe sections that were seated there. We only did a fairly small area because this was kind of a pilot study, basically a little over an acre, half a hectare. It was an open area, no problems with GPS. You know, terrain was easy, very little vegetation. So it was a relatively easy test, but this was really the first time out of the box for doing demonstrations where we had the sensor moving along and we're trying to detect targets as well as classify them. This slide here just shows you the two surveys. The EM61, they did half a meter lane spacing. Average speed was around a meter a second, a little over. For the 2x2 TEM array, we did a little bit tighter lanes. Average speed was, you know, close, comparable, a little bit slower. But so the net production rate was about 80% of what we were getting with the EM61. But if you look at the two survey maps, you see that the features are more or less the same, the basic features, but there's a much higher resolution with the 2x2 TEMTADs. And that's because if you remember back to the picture, we had those four transmitter receiver pairs that were each about, in this case, they were 40 centimeters square compared to the EM61, which is a whole meter wide. So we get a little bit better detail with the sensor. And that's shown up in this plot here where we compare the 2x2 and the EM61 and kind of a blow up along one of the lines. Again, basic features are similar, but there is much more detail in the 2x2 picture. Now that's a blessing and a curse because it means that you have more opportunities to pick targets, but then maybe you should pick those targets. I struggled a little bit with how to present the information on detection performance. And this is what I came up with. And what I've plotted here are the signal levels out of the 2x2 sensor and the EM61 sensor for all of the anomalies at Spencer Range in that dynamic area. And the gray circles ended up being clutter items. The blue symbols were targets of interest, either any of those munitions items or pipe seeds. I've also shown the sort of the threshold picks, pick levels for these two sensors. For the EM61, it's here, 2x2 here. And it turns out that all of the targets of interest were in fact picked by both the 2x2 and the EM61. And if you look along here, kind of the ratio of the signals for those targets of interest is about what you would expect, you know, sort of a diagonal coming up out of the intersection of the two thresholds. But what you notice is that there are a lot of targets in here, and I can show that to you this way, a lot of targets in here, and they're the ones that are highlighted in red, that the EM61 picked that were not picked in the 2x2 survey. And similarly, there were targets that were picked in the 2x2 survey that were not picked in the EM61 survey. And I'll kind of, scoot back and forth between the two of them. You can see that typically they live near the threshold level, and they're above threshold with one of the sensors and below threshold with the other. And that's typically what you would expect with things that look at the ground a little bit differently. There is one important element up here, and that is if you look closer, you can see there's some red circles up here in this area here, which were above the EM61 threshold, and so the EM61 probably should have picked them up. But it didn't because of that resolution issue. That is that sometimes the EM61 will kind of smear a couple of targets, a couple of anomalies together because it has that whole meter-wide footprint, and they get resolved individually as a pair of picks by the smaller sensor, the sensor that has a smaller footprint of a 40 centimeter square. But basically, the picture that emerges from here is that of all the targets that really mattered, those up in here, the blue ones, both sensors are perfectly capable of picking them up. When you start talking about small frag, small pieces of clutter, you're going to get probably more extra ones picked up by the 2x2 than you are by the EM61. But it's not overwhelming. So, you know, basically, our conclusion out of this is that it seemed to be doing pretty well for detection, at least in this particular site. Classification performance is shown on this slide, and Herb introduced you to the receiver operating characteristic, the ROC curve. And this is not one of the ones that he fires people for. This is one of the ones that goes up quickly and then levels off. It turns out that of the 339 target anomalies in that area, almost 70% of them we were able to classify using the survey data. That means that only 30% of those targets would have to be revisited with the sensor to do cued ID on. And overall, all of the targets of interest were recovered with only 18% of the remaining clutter items excavated. That's this section here. 100% of the target of interest, 18% of the clutter. So all in all, the 2x2 seems to be doing very well. It's going to be going through some additional demonstration and testing this year and into next year. And that will really determine, you know, the final development of it and where we're going to be going next. But to basically just summarize what we know so far, we did get detection performance, which seems to be comparable to the EM61. The production rate didn't suffer significantly, about 80% of what we were getting with an EM61. Now, that's with 50-centimeter lanes on the EM61. If you backed off on that, you would get a higher production rate with the 61, but you might suffer in detection performance. Importantly, we were able to eliminate 70% of the queued ID visits, and the classification that was done was very good. The final development will be driven by what goes on over the next couple of years in the ESDCP demos and other field experience. Like as Herb mentioned, testing that will be done down at Vieques by NAVFAC. So probably, you know, maybe late 2014 for production availability, it remains to be seen. Things that we would like to perhaps do as this production winds up, we would like to improve the production rate, and that could be done either by going with wider lane spacing, although we have to be a little more careful in how we do that, registering lane to lane. Maybe alternative array configurations or vehicle towed systems. This was an easy test in terms of vegetation and terrain. If you were to take it someplace where you weren't able to have the you know, the ground cleared quite as well, or if there were a lot of rocks and things like that, that would slow you down quite a bit. These sensors, we didn't stress it before, but typically with the advanced sensors, we try and keep them fairly close to the ground. If we had, and this one is typically running about 20 centimeters off the ground, whereas the EM61 may be more like 40 centimeters off the ground for the bottom coil. If we were to put it up that high, we would take a hit in some of our performance. It seems to be doing okay, but there's a lot of information in this sensor because of all of the different transmitters and different orientations of receivers. And so we might actually be able to come up with a smarter way of picking targets than just thresholding on a contour map, something that may use all of the available sensor information. And that could, in fact, improve detection performance. I just wanted to close by showing some of the other things that people are working on that are capable of combined detection and classification. Herb showed you a picture of this guy here, the man portable vector sensor. That was also at Spencer Range doing survey mode classification. The metal mapper can do detection, but right now it's not currently configured to do classification as it's moving. That could, those modifications would be pretty straightforward. And there's another sensor system that was being developed under CERTIP and ESTCP called the Optima, which hasn't been to any of the classification demos yet, but has been to one of the standardized test sites. And that'll be coming along in the next year or so. And so over the next year and a half, we'll probably be seeing some comparisons and shakedowns as we kind of decide what, you know, what technology seems to work for what sorts of site conditions. And that's pretty much all I had to say. So if we've got any questions, we're glad to see what we can do.
Excellent. Very good. Thank you, Tom. Good information on looking at ways that, you know, the advanced sensors can be used for both the detection and the classification. I'm sure that'll be an increasing area of interest for improving our production rates. Good scoop. We do have a couple of questions here from the audience, and we have time that I think that we can field these. So
okay.
The first question was, you show the 10 pads with a 2x2 array. Is that arrangement, is that geometry needed for this to work, or can they be ganged together? Can they be strung together to improve the coverage during a single pass?
That was what I meant when I talked about alternative array configurations, yes. One could take the four of them and put them side by side and cover twice as much territory and probably not suffer much of a hit in terms of classification performance. Once you start getting too many of them across, then because, you know, you've got to cycle through them, you can't fire them all simultaneously, you've got to cycle through, then the rate at which the entire array can be fired slows down. You know, like if you had eight of them, instead of being able to do 7.5 hertz, you'd be down to, you know, a little less than 4 hertz. That would slow your long track data rate or reduce your long track data rate. So you probably wouldn't want to go too wide, but yeah, you could probably double the width and you could probably pull it behind an ATV if you set it up right.
Okay, very good. You showed improved anomaly resolutions for the 10 pads. Do you think we can expect similar improvements with the metal mapper? Because, you know, it's got a different transmitter and receiver coil arrangements.
It does. It has bigger transmitters, but it has, when you look at how the receiver coils are laid out from left to right, I mean, they vary in position front, back, but left to right, the spacing there is what really is going to determine or dominate your resolution. And the fact that as you're going along track, that those receiver coils are fairly small. So I would expect that it would have, I'll say similar, but I haven't gone through the numbers to say exactly how it would compare, but resolution that looked more like the 2x2s than the EM61.
Okay, all right. When do you think software will become available to allow the production contractors to process dynamic data?
Today. Right now, down at Fort Rucker, they're doing dynamic data. It's not a I guess it's an unreleased version of UX Analyze is being used. But that's in the queue, and it'll be coming along very shortly. I think Nava Geophysics is working with some of our guys to make sure that gets taken care of properly.
Okay. Does geology affect the performance of the sensor?
Certainly. If you have highly magnetic soil, that where the permeability or the susceptibility varies a lot, you know, like people have seen, you know, in some areas, especially like if you go to someplace like Hawaii, that can have a significant effect on the performance, just as it will, you know, have a significant effect on the performance of the EM61.
Okay. Do you think that there are some forward speed limitations in using the 10 TADS when you use it for both detection and classification? You know, are there limits on how fast you can move with it?
The limitation on speed is more a speed and terrain combination. The problem that you get into is if this thing starts bouncing around a lot, it gets noisy. And that's because it's being flipped back and forth in the Earth's field, and you get a time-varying magnetic field that interferes with your signal. And so if you're driving too fast over bumpy ground, you'll get a hit on your performance due to increased noise. There is another effect, of course, which is the faster you go, the more widely spaced your samples are along the track. But, you know, as long as you're still, you know, only talking about, you know, less than 5 miles an hour, I don't think that that's a terribly important factor. We're getting enough data.
Got it. Okay. So putting it behind the Dukes of Hazzard, General Lee is probably not ever
probably not a good idea. No, I would put it in, you know, in the same categories. You know, some of the arrays of EM61s that people have used in the past, you know, on some of these sites, you know, where they've ganged them together, you know, and they put them behind an ATV or something like that. But again, typically you're only going, you know, a couple few meters a second.
Right. Okay. Are there any plans to test the usability of these systems underwater?
Yeah. Well, there are several ESTCP projects that are looking at underwater applications of this sort of technology, and also some work under the sister program, CERTIP. It's probably going to be another year or two before people get an idea of how well these things will work underwater. The dominant problem there is getting it close to the bottom. I mentioned before that we like to keep these things close to the targets. And so if you've got to, you know, like fly it along fairly high off the bottom, you may be out of luck.
That one. And it's, if sensor movement affects how well the equipment works, how well do you think the handheld sensor, the MPV, is going to work in comparison?
It suffers the same sorts of problems. Although if the person is holding it above the ground and it's not in contact with the ground through wheels, then you know, perhaps it won't suffer the jolting and jostling that you know, something that's rolling over the ground might on uneven ground. But I think the performance that we saw at Spencer Range, which again was a relatively benign place, was that the MPV and the 2x2 seemed to do about equally well.
Okay. I think we have time for one more question before our break here. And this last one is there anything special about doing the inversions with the existing software?
No. No, there are several sets of ways that people do this, you know, several software packages that people use. I don't think that they all seem to do about the same job, in my experience.
Okay.
Excellent. And in fact, one thing I should have mentioned, one thing that's happening with these sensors for the CUDE is that people are building the inversion into the data acquisition so that you can tell in the field. Can't do that as you're in the CUDE, in the survey mode, though, obviously. You wouldn't be able to pay attention to it.
Okay, gotcha. Well, Tom, very good information and very good job of fielding the questions that we got. Excellent with that. So we want to thank you for that. And now we're scheduled to have an intermission. We know that having a webinar this long is a little bit challenging. So we're going to take a 15-minute intermission, go get a Coke and some popcorn, and please, everybody, be back at 2:45. We will start back up crisply at 2:45. We are going to get started again in just about a minute.
Okay, Duane, this is Jean. It looks like we've come up on our scheduled end time for the break. Would you like to go ahead and resume today's session?
Yes, let's go ahead and get started. One thing that I was going to mention is if we haven't had time to get your questions answered during the actual presentation itself, I just wanted to remind everybody that we do have a segment at the end of the webinar for questions answer, open discussion, and we'll try to get to any unanswered questions at that point in time. Our next speaker is Mr. Kevin Kingdon, and Kevin comes to us from Black Tusk Geophysics. Kevin is also a research geophysicist and has been very, very active with the CERTIP ESTCP projects. So, Kevin, you should be in the driver's seat.
Okay, thanks, Duane, and thanks, everybody, for calling in. It's been interesting presentations so far for me. I've learned some, a lot of stuff here. So my talk, I want to look at an overview of some of Black Tusk Geophysics' involvement at some of the different ESTCP live sites. And really the main focus I want to work towards is looking at a site. And I'm going to look at two specific sites for comparison. One, Herb had mentioned earlier, was Pole Mountain. And then the second one is Camp Biela. We'll see that those two sites have two different levels of data quality, which really constrain the how aggressive we can be with our classification approach. So I was fortunate enough to follow both Herb and Tom, who covered a lot of the background material really, really well. So I might go through some of these slides a little bit quicker than intended. But I just wanted to start off by talking about our involvement. So we started early on with the Camp Seibert, which was, as Herb mentioned, the one of the first sites, and so a relatively easy classification problem. They had a single type of large target there. And as time has gone on, the sites have gotten progressively more difficult in terms of multiple targets of interest at a site, significant amounts of clutter that are of the same size as those targets, topography of the sites, and some of the magnetic soil effects coming into play as well. But fortunately, I guess, the in parallel to the increasing level of difficulty of these sites, the instrumentation and the purpose-built sensors for classification, such as the TEMTAS, I think that's the 5x5 you can see in the middle slide here, as well as the metal mapper over here, and also metal mapper deployed off the front of an ATV here. They've really given us this rich data sets that we're able to do classification with. They give us these multiple look angles that Herb showed in his talk, and it really has driven the process a lot further down the path than it was in 2008 at that the simple site starting out at Camp Seibert. So it's really been an interesting development of both hardware and method and software methods to deal with the challenges. So specifically, I'm going to look at metal mapper data from two different sites. They're both from 2011. There's Pole Mountain in Wyoming, which you can see on the right here. It looks like a sort of a beautiful place to survey, nice blue skies, wide open areas. And then Camp Biela, which looks a little more treed. And we're going to see that there's a difference in terms of the data. I also want to look at how can we tell that we should be implementing a more conservative strategy? What clues can we have in terms of the data to make those decisions? So again, this was covered, but there's really three stages to our detection and classification for UXO, much like Tom and Herb had already explained. That first, we want to acquire some data over an unknown target. The next step is we want to extract some features that tell us something about that data, something about that unknown target from the data. And finally, we want to form a feature vector and use that as input. We want to do some classification and come up ultimately with a prioritized dig list where we have high likelihood UXO and high likelihood clutter ordered, so that we can do those in order of our digs. So polarizabilities have been discussed both in general terms by Herb and also by Tom, and I'm going to harp on them again because it's really a critical component for the classification that we're going to talk about later. So the polarizabilities, they are intrinsic parameters, and that is, they tell us something about the target that's generated them. So for our UXOs, we're kind of now, everybody's aware of the fact that they're generally large amplitudes. So big is bad, in Herb's words, surely, and they're slow decaying. So we wind up with this a large L1 polarizability, which you can see here. And then because of the axial symmetry of the two targets, we wind up with two equal secondary polarizabilities. And that's because you can see the axial symmetry. We have UXOs are typically, what we're looking at is a cylinder-type shape. So we have that long axis, the blue along the middle, and then approximately equal red and green axes shown as well. Now, conversely, if we have a piece of scrap or frag which has no axial symmetry to it, that's going to be reflected in the polarizabilities we recover. And so as a result, you can see on the right here, we have three sort of distinct polarizabilities. And that's the kind of shape information that we're going to use to try and classify UXO versus non-UXO. So because these polarizabilities are determined by inverting or fitting data with a model, the accuracy with which they can be estimated, it really depends on the quality of the data that's there. So as our data quality decreases, unfortunately, so does our classification ability. So we've got three different scenarios here. So on the left, what I call all polarizabilities. And that in that scenario, what I'm saying is we have good recovery of all three polarizabilities, both the L1, the blue, and then the green and the red, the L2 and L3. And if we have those, we can get sort of class. That's the best kind of scenario we can expect in terms of a classification performance. And in the sites I'm going to show you some examples from after this, Pole Mountain falls into this category. It's just a tremendous site for data quality. It's one of the best data sets I've seen in terms of the quality of the data that was recorded there. So that gives us classification information both on size in terms of, you know, the response. You saw Herb compare 75 millimeter polarizabilities versus a 37. You can see that distinct generally the shape. So is it an axisymmetric item that's going to be high likelihood UXO, or is it something that has, say, all three unique polarizabilities, or something like the fuse that Herb showed where you have all three identical polarizabilities? But whatever they are, they're going to give us some indication on the shape of the target. Is it plate-like? Is it more like a cylinder? Is there symmetry to it? Now, if we get to a stage where the data quality maybe isn't quite there, and this is how Camp Beale falls into this category here, I would say, we look at something called the total polarizability. And what that is simply it's the sum of the L1 plus L2 plus L3. So we're just summing those three, and I think I have an animation here that should. So there you can see they're summing up, and we wind up with a single, just that black curve there, which is the total polarizability. I can go back and just show that again. It's just the sum of those. So what happens there is we lose a little bit of our classification information because at this point we no longer have all three of those polarizabilities well defined. So we can't rely on it. We can't say much about the shape of the target because we don't have a comparison between the primary and the secondary polarizabilities when we start switching to that total polarizability. And then if things get somewhat degraded further, then we kind of drop down into doing something more of a simplistic approach just with a size decay. And that's really the simplest representation. And some of the challenges that Tom mentioned with the EM61, with the resolution over that wide loop, that's generally where the best we can hope for with EM61 data is doing a simple size decay comparison there. So the first site, which I talked about, is Pole Mountain, Wyoming. This is Metal Mapper data. You can see there is the Metal Mapper mounted in front of the ATV. So it encompasses both the Metal Mapper sensor. There's an RTK GPS and an inertial motion unit to determine the pitch, roll, and yaw of the sensor. And there's also there's been software developed that allows the users to invert the targets in the field, the operator there, as they collect the data. So It's pretty good for ensuring data quality because what it permits is instead of the data them going to an observed location, they follow some arrows and then they collect that data, and then it's processed the night after, and they say, well, you know, you need to actually shift 30, 40 centimeters, go back and try and relocate that. This gives them the ability to actually reposition while they're there in the field. So it's much easier to guide them where a source location is determined after running an inversion in the field. So you can see that at that site there is, a range of targets from small ISO, and that's the industry standard object. Those are those small lengths of pipes that Tom was mentioning in his talk. And those are convenient just because they're a cylindrical shape just like our targets, but they're also very easily accessible. You could walk to your Home Depot, go down the pipe aisle and pick up, 20 of these to seed your site. So they're very important for that purpose. And I'm going to show a little bit later, not just in terms of being able to test sensors and processing methods for seeding with the ISOs, but it also actually provides us with an opportunity to compare the level of difficulty from site to site based on how well we're able to recover the polarizabilities of these small ISOs. And I've got some examples coming up where we'll talk about that. And Herb also had an example showing the horseshoes there. And Pole Mountain was definitely a site where we saw multiple things that had very, very similar polarizabilities that were sort of bordering on plate-like, but certainly not the axisymmetric UXOs that we expect to see. And so we requested a couple of those training, and sure enough, they turned out to be horseshoes. And in a way, what we're doing with classification is we want to identify all of the high likelihood TOI and UXOs on the site, but we also want to have confidence that what we're leaving in the site is a piece of clutter or something that's not a target of interest. And so if we can have a unique signature to something like a horseshoe, then that gives people the confidence to say, wow, not only can they find these UXO, but they can also find certain types of clutter that are repeatable and that they can leave in the ground. So I think it just shows the power of the methods to not only identify UXO, but also certain types of clutter that are very repeatable in their shape and their polarizabilities. So when we look at feature extraction, we have three main stages here. We want to estimate the target parameters, and we'll do that by running single and two source inversions. We now have a three object inversion we run as well. And the reason that it's important to run those multi-object inversions is that you can imagine the metal mapper, the sensor head itself is about 1 meter by 1 meter square. So it's not inconceivable that there could be multiple targets underneath that sensor head and contributing to the observed response. So by doing these multi-object inversions, we're able to accurately identify the contributions, the relative contributions of multiple targets that may be present there, which helps us just more accurately determine which are our targets and what those polarizabilities are. So we'll also get our location, orientation, and polarizabilities. And that location and orientation, they're what guides our in-field operators back to recollect if they're not properly centered over the target. And we do data inversion and QC. And so what we're looking for there is poor fits to the data. So we want to get out any of these items that are can't analyze, where if there's a GPS glitch or a sensor failure that maybe wasn't noticed in the field and the data is now in the hands, they've left the field. There may be occasional items where you just have to say that has to be dug. And they're quite rare, but it does happen. So as Herb mentioned, if there's nothing that you can get from the data, you have to dig it to be certain. And then you have model selection as well. And the QC and the model selection, they're really the least efficient part of the processing workflow because it often involves an analyst just flipping through all the anomalies and reviewing the recovered polarizabilities. So it's not only time-consuming, but it also does introduce the possibility of human error into the process. So a lot of our focus has been on developing software tools and metrics to kind of assist the analyst in making that process more efficient, the whole QC and model selection. And so along those lines, here's an example of our current, what we call the data QC tool. So with the development of these classification-specific sensors, it's been great in terms of the richness of data it provides with the multiple look angles at targets to really, really do classification justice. But it's also a bit tricky because the volume of data it generates really makes the analyst decision a bit more, there's just a lot more information to consider. So we've tried to come up with a single screen that sort of encompasses all of the information that we find is useful for making a decision on a particular target. So it includes things such as the actual decays shown right here. That's both the observed and predicted, for each of the receivers cubes. So there's 7 receiver cubes. Each has 3 component receivers. So it's, you know, you've got a lot of data shown there. And what we use these for is, let's say there's a particular receiver cube had a bad component or something. It's important to know that in the inversion procedure. We might want to exclude that. And it's not often that happens, but it does occasionally. And this view allows you to pick out things like that so that you can avoid making some of those mistakes when inverting the data. We also have the polarizability shown here. We have the gridded image from the detection survey. So this is actually, in this case, it was an EM61 survey. And you can see what the black square there is showing where the metal mapper was positioned. So it gives us a way of determining if we're directly centered over our target. And in this case, it gives you a guide like, well, maybe I want to run a multi-object inversion because I actually see there's something near the corner of my array metal mapper in the EM61 data that might be contributing. So some other just metrics here that are just numbers that aren't really important going into details, but then you have your size decay feature space. So the stars indicate items that are in our reference library, and what we're looking for is items that cluster around some of our reference items, and that's kind of what we want to get in that display there. So that's just the QC tool. So once we've QC'd the data, we're going to do classification. So we're going to request training data. You know, when we come to the site, we don't really have an idea of what's there quite often, so we're going to be requesting some training data. We're going to create a ranked anomaly list. Usually, we're typically doing a library matching method, so using the reference library and coming back with some sort of match on the misfits to those. And there's also statistical classifiers, which I won't go into much here. And the final stage is we need to determine a stop digging point. And that's right now at this stage. We do that usually via a manual inspection, a visual inspection of the dig list. And the analyst will have to make a judgment call. Okay, I'm at a point now where I have a high confidence that I've notified all my targets of interest at this site. So looking at the training data request, in this case, we've put together some algorithms that look at the feature space, and they allow the analyst to draw polygons around potential target clusters. So in this case, the analyst drew this a red polygon here around this target cluster that they saw in the size decay feature space. And so what this is showing is that we generally think sort of larger targets, slower decaying. This is generally where our UXO are occurring, and this small, fast decaying is typically the clutter on the sites. And you'll see in the next slide, there's sometimes exceptions to that. But in this case, the analyst drew a polygon, and they just ran the algorithm to look for self-similar polarizabilities. And in this case, they found 27 matches. They're all plotted on the same plot here. So the red is the primaries for each of the 27 targets, and then the green and the gray are the secondaries, and the average values are just shown in the black dashed line. So in this case, we would ask for training data for a couple of these, and we found that it, in fact, was a small ISO. So that's, again, the industry standard object, so that's something that we would add to our library and make sure we're able to find it. Now, there's also the scenario where sometimes you'll find something that's not an obvious visual cluster. I think if any users were looking here, it would be hard-pressed to look into this cloud of items in the size decay plot and say, oh, there's definitely something in here. But by drawing a polygon, the algorithm is sort of, you know, it doesn't need eyes to see it. It's just comparing an unbiased view of what things look similar to other things. And so we found, again, Herb mentioned these, this 6-centimeter fuse. And so it was certainly something, you know, when we saw 34 items that were very similar to each other in this case of having very equal polarizabilities, it's not something that's axisymmetric that we would typically think is a UXO, but we have to find out what it is, so we request training data on that. And in this case, it was ultimately determined to not be a target of interest, but important to know that. So here's an example now of looking at applying an aggressive strategy to pole mountain, and these are the ROC curves that Herb discussed. And so this was done by a black tusk analyst. And so this is pole mountain data. So it was the data from year one showed that it was just excellent quality, providing good resolution of all 3 polarizabilities. So they required a very aggressive match to all 3 polarizabilities. And that turned out to be an aggressive strategy was very prudent for this site because of the high data quality. So it was broken up into 2 years to try and basically half the targets were given initially, and then the analyst had a chance to submit that year one dig list, review the results, and then maybe make some modifications before doing the year two submission. So in this case, year one was submitted, the rock curve goes virtually straight up, which is great. It's what you'd like to see. And it reduced 88% reduction in the total number of digs. For year two, I think the analyst asked for five additional items in training that I thought perhaps might be something of interest. They all turned out to be non-TOI, so the exact same aggressive strategy was used, and an 84% dig reduction was obtained there. So if we look at this at a second site that's a little bit different, if we go to Beale, and what would happen if we applied that same aggressive strategy here? I'm going to show you what happens and why that happens. And so we're going to look at two different classification results from Camp Beale. One, using that exact same aggressive approach that we used at Pole Mountain, and secondly, a more conservative two-stage approach. And we'll see what happens at there and why that's the case. So first things that I'm going to do is compare the results. These are just all of the ISOs, these small little sections of pipe for each site. So you can see this is Pole Mountain on the left, on the right. This is Pole Mountain. So you can see how well constrained these are. They're just very repeatable, very tight. There's little variation over all. I think there was maybe 20 to 30 of these items there. Conversely, when we go to Camp Beale, there was two different data sets collected, one by Parsons and one by CH2M Hill, and it was just a very difficult site in terms of geological noise. You can see that we don't have that same tightness to the parameter, to the polarizabilities that we saw at Pole Mountain, and this is going to be much more difficult if we apply aggressive strategy where all three polarizabilities have to match, because you can see there's substantial variation, particularly in those secondary polarizabilities. So just for reference sake, actually, here's the Spencer, which is a recent site from 2012 and the polarizabilities. And you can kind of see it gives you a gauge of where it falls in terms of level of difficulty. It's certainly an improvement over Camp Beale, but it's not quite the ideal scenario we had at Pole Mountain. So what happens when we apply that same aggressive strategy that works so well at Pole Mountain to Camp Beale? And unfortunately, what happens is that we can see there's two ISO seeds missed here. And so, you know, the rock curve starts off quite well. It's going vertical like we would like to see. But you'd always like to see this operating point to the left of your stop dig point. Because when it's over here, that means that some of your target of interest were missed. So if we take a little look closer as to what happened and why those were missed, here's the polarizabilities for those two items that were missed. And again, what we see is that, as we saw and when we looked at all of the ISO results stacked on one another, the secondary polarizabilities are shown in gray. This is the reference library shown in gray for the ISO. And you can see that these black and green secondaries, we're just not able to constrain them. They're sort of deep for an ISO small target at 19 centimeters and 20 centimeters, and there's just enough effect from soil response on the signal-to-noise ratio that these are hindered. And so as a result, we're not able to recover them. So the prudent thing to do at this site is if we look at our primary polarizability, which is largely going to be our total polarizability because it's just the sum of all three of these, you can see it's still a very good match in both shape and size to our reference library. So the second analyst, which was working independently on the other data set from collected at this site, decided on a more conservative approach where initially they worked exactly the same as the three polarizability approach. So all of the high likelihood TOI targets were initially identified requiring all three polarizabilities to match. But at a certain point, the analyst felt that, well, some of these targets really just are not resolving the secondary polarizabilities well. So once they reached a point where they felt all the highest quality three polarizability targets were obtained, they switched their criterion to just be the total polarizability. And in doing so, they were able to get those two ISO items where they just had the primary polarizability constrained well. And so that's why at this site that was, you know, a more conservative approach was necessary. And it just indicates that as the sites become more difficult, experience and the ability to cross-reference the level of difficulty is important. So enough of sort of showing some of our rock curves. Another part of our ESTCP participation is working with industry partners. So for both Pole Mountain and Spencer Range, we had groups come up to Vancouver and they spent a week with us going through. By and large, they would put together the dig list on their own and submit things. And they got some really great results. And again, as Herb mentioned, these were first-time people working on classification data. So the results are even more impressive, taking that into consideration. And you can see how the level of difficulty of the site really affects the overall performance. So the rock curve on the left is from Pole Mountain, and it's the textbook straight up that you want to see. And that's great, and that's easily obtainable with this level of data quality. And no USO or mixed. And going to a little more challenging site at Spencer Range, you can see, again, the great results. No UXO were missed. They were smart in the sense that they said, you know what, it's a little tougher. I'm going to ask for some more training data. That's why things shift more to the right here. And the curve goes straight up. And then at the end, it's a little more difficult to get some of these stragglers. But ultimately, they choose their stop dig point at an excellent location. And again, no UXO were missed. So some pretty good results. And these were both created from various people from Shaw as they had come in. So good results all around there. And just in terms of dollars and cents and why classification is beneficial. This is sort of similar to the pie charts Herb had, but slightly different plotting of it. So if we take Pole Mountain as a case study here, and the standard approach, when I refer to standard approach, I'm saying that's sending an EM61 sensor out and you're going to dig everything. So there's 2,370 anomalies that have to be dug. If we go to classification, we send the metal mapper out to follow up, and then we reduce the number of digs to 331. So we have 86% fewer excavations required. Now, if we look at what that translates into cost, you can see that you have a detection survey at the standard approach. That's at this point your EM61, or if, like Tom suggests, that may get melded right in with the classification as these sensors get better and better. And then the bulk of your cost is just digging. You know, you've got 2,370 anomalies to get through. If we look at the classification approach, it's that same cost to do your detection survey, and then you have the additional cost of sending the metal mapper out to all 2,370 locations, but you really reduce your digging cost by 86% fewer digs. And so just by assigning some typical numbers to these costs, so we project a 47% savings. So it's definitely something where there is value to be obtained at some of these sites. And that's in conclusion, just a few of the things I wanted to point out today were, you know, the need for a reliable quality control process and understanding the limitations of the data. And those ISOs, because they appear on so many sites, they're actually a pretty good comparison from site to site to determine, you know, how difficult this classification problem is. And then using that information to select an appropriate classification strategy for that site. And just in closing, I want to acknowledge CERTIP and ESTCP, who've certainly funded all of the work that I've displayed here, and it's been a very important partner for us. And that's all I had to say today. Thanks everyone.
Excellent, very good, Kevin. Hey, very much appreciate you extracting and presenting some of the practical lessons from our demonstration project. Good job at that. I think we have time for maybe one or two questions before our next speaker. And so first question that popped up is, you mentioned the Pole Mountain data quality, that's the best that you've seen. Is that because of the real-time inversion that you you explained?
In fact, I don't think in that case they were actually running the real-time inversion that they had started out, but it's just a case of the site itself had so low noise. The sensor itself, I think, was generally positioned lower than it has been at some of the other sites when looking at the data. So I think that helped a little bit, but I think it was by and large just the fact that the site itself was really well geared. There's almost no noise sources. And certainly the field crews collecting it did a great job as well, but I don't think it's a question from site to site that's been a big variable. I think it really was just that when you compare it with Camp Beale, it was just the increased mag soil effects at Camp Beale that were not present at Pole Mountain.
Okay, excellent. Maybe one more quick question. Was there a determination of the cause of the differences in the signal noise ratio between the three sites? I mean, whether it was ambient or geologic or instrument issues, whatever?
Yeah, we've done some analysis of that, and it's almost exclusively, I think, geologic. Certainly at Camp Beale, that was the main contributing factor. The positioning was slightly better at Pole Mountain than at Camp Beale, But in general, I think that's been a determining factor, has been the presence of some sort of geological noise.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Our next presentation is from John Jackson. John is with the Corps of Engineers. He's representing the Range Support Center, one of our munitions design centers. And John's been working with Sergeant in the STCP on some of the projects for a couple of years now. So, John, I believe your presentation is ready to go.
Thank you, Dwayne. So far today, we've listened to Herb Nelson give a general summary of the advanced classification process. Kevin just took us through some recent demonstration results and pointed out some key features. And then Tom Bell provided a state of the industry and sort of a look of what's to come in the dynamic arena. Based on some of the questions we've been receiving, I'm going to guess that the two biggest questions out there are, how is this technology going to be contracted, and when is this technology going to be contracted? Not surprisingly, we at the Corps had the same questions, so we put together this pilot study on the contracting and use of advanced classification with the intent of addressing these questions, and hopefully we've put together a model or template from which we can learn. So what I'd like to do today is take you through the background and results of the pilot study on the contracting and use, and ultimately end at a third question I'm sure is on everybody's mind: how much does all this stuff cost? Going back to 2010, Camp Beale was selected as the fourth site in the ESDCP series of demonstrations. Demonstrations 1 through 3 were selected to validate the technology, but these were in relatively easy settings. Camp Beale offered a setting with wooded and open areas, hilly terrain, and rocky outcrops. This particular area, shown here, was where 4 historical firing ranges overlapped. 50 acres of land were mapped at 0.75-meter line spacing as part of a pseudo-RI effort by ESTCP. A subset of those 50 acres, roughly 10 acres, was selected for the demonstration and remapped at half-meter line spacing with the intent of better positioning data. During the site walk, the California Department of Toxic Substance Control and USAIS discussed what should be done with the remaining acreage. This was sort of the seedling for a pilot study which was planted in everyone's minds with the concept that if ESTCP's demonstration proved successful and verified by digging all the targets, which is what they have done every demonstration, then advanced EMI data would be collected on the remaining acreage with the idea that the non-TOI list would be left in the ground. The scope of work was approved in January 2012 by both DTSC and USAIS, and every step of the way since then has been in full collaboration with the state. Another key point from this slide is we plan to use the 0.75-meter line spacing for our queued locations, so we needed to confirm the original survey could locate all the TOI. It could, and it also did so by using the 5.2 millivolt threshold. However, in an act of one part good faith, one part curiosity, and honestly one part stupidity, we lowered the threshold to 4.5 millivolts in an attempt to capture all of the non-TOI from the original demonstration, and based on the calculated response of a 37 millimeter at a foot horizontally near the edge of a coil. Another point to take away from this slide is we funded it in three different phases. What we called internally as phase zero was the blind seeding of inert seeds and industry standard objects, small, medium, and large. This was a multitask sole source award on a existing contract to TLI. Phase one was funded in spring 2012. This was part of a joint effort with ESTCP in contracting a company that had previously demonstrated experience and success at Camp Beale. This was awarded to Parsons. And then again in December 2012, a request for proposal that went out under a competitive multitask award contract that was again awarded to Parsons. There was a variety of reasons for contracting in phases, but the main purpose was one, to accommodate funding and timing issues, and two, and probably most importantly, at least from the perspective of a good science project, an ability to take lessons learned from the previous phase and apply them to the new phase. So I'm hoping we have a good understanding of what the project is by this point, but I want to reiterate we are collaborating with DTSC in order to apply classification in a real-world setting, and hopefully we agree to leave metal in the ground. This will be done two parts. Phase one is development agreement of the dig list, and part two is development agreement of the verification strategy. You'll notice I've switched from three to two phases here, and that's because even though we contracted in three actions, there are really two main phases in meeting the objectives of this pilot study. Keeping the objectives of the pilot study in mind, I think it's important that we understand what we will and will not get out of the work to be completed. We will get a classification verification process that is hopefully acceptable to both USACE and DTSC. We will get UXO recovery from roughly 25 more acres, and most significantly, we will have a model, even if it's with a lot of lessons learned, but we will have a model to implement advanced classification on future projects. Now, what we will not get, and speaking on behalf of DTSC, this is probably the most important slide of the talk because of the two bullets on the right. We agreed up front that we will not be leaving behind a proven UXO-free site, and we will not have a response complete for the MRS. The MRS will continue down the normal CERCLA process. So on to the field results, or field work and results. This is a zoomed-in image. On the right, we have 6,363 metal mapper targets. These are depicted in green. The blue targets are the TEMTAD targets. There's 2,806 of them. Going into a little more detail on the TOI based on how they were added to the dig list. During previous talks, the concept of three different beta curves was discussed. Kevin went on to describe the importance of the beta 1 curves at Camp Beale. So under this classification scheme that we selected for Camp Beale, queued data were compared to the library using all three curves. These were the priority 1, only two curves. These were the priority 2, and just one curve. These were the priority 3. There was also a feature space comparison, which resulted in the fourth priority level. The size prediction was also made. For this pilot study, not only were we trying to put all of the TOI on the dig list, but we were also attempting to make general predictions about the size of each anomaly. In this case, we had three overlapping categories of small, medium, large. During the digging process, these size predictions will be compared to the dig results in the hopes of adding validity to the classification process. For obvious reasons, we removed all of the can analyzes from the size predictions, along with some of the other calculated metrics you'll see later. So if the numbers aren't adding up, it's not just my poor math skills. There might be a valid reason for it. So here's the flow chart depicting our classification scheme that will probably give any sane person a headache. We have received a lot of feedback on this, none of it positive, so I will not discuss this in detail, but I encourage you to contact me if you have any questions. But the key feature to take away from this flowchart is we have two main branches, one for can't analyze, and this is sort of a QC branch for the decision-making as well, and then we have one for the four methods of library comparison and feature space addition, and how a target is included or excluded from the dig list. Since we're proposing to leave metal on the ground, the next step is to verify we've done the right thing. This gives all the stakeholders confidence that UXO has not been left behind. This verification process actually starts from the beginning of the QA, with QA of the collection, then QA of the inversion, then QA of the classification processes, and then ends at the stage that we're beginning in the real world right now with the non-TOI list to dig. We're calling this verification digging. We have several key items during the collection process. This includes running the metal mapper or TEMTADs over the IVS strip twice a day, collecting appropriate number of backgrounds. In this case, it was at least every 2 hours. A test on inverted positioning versus center of coil, and a test of inverted positioning versus EM61 positioning. I've gotten a lot of questions on that particular QC check, so I'll go into a little more detail and say that if you've used the metal mapper, you've experienced the dancing arrows, And sometimes we were concerned the dancing arrows might drive you away from the EM61 location, the original EM61 location, a little too far. So we did add that QC check. We also have several elements in the QA of the inversion process that we want to go through. To me, the coolest item on the chart is the predicted positioning in relation to the actual positioning. Since we have not actually gone out and dug anything yet, these results are based on the known locations for the seeds only. The standard deviation across all of the seeds results in some pretty spectacular numbers, 7 centimeters horizontally for Metal Mapper, 12.4 for TemTads, and then vertically or in the depth direction, 13.6 and 10.0. What this means in layman terms is the future of digless might be telling the dig team they have a 105 buried nose down at 95 centimeters instead of telling them they have to dig a target at such and such location, and then the UXO team being angry at the geophysicist for having them dig wire repeatedly. The key point from QA of the classification process is that all the seeds were labeled as TOI. They were all of the seeds that we put out there were on the dig list. And honestly, this shouldn't be a surprise to anybody after listening to all of the previous talks. Another interesting point is I mentioned size, and I'll go into a little more detail on the next slide, but for 93% of the TOI items, we identified the correct size. For another cool stat for the money holders is greater than 92% of the clutter items were left behind for Metal Mapper, and greater than 87% of the clutter items for TemTads were left behind. That means ideally we are not digging those unless they pop up on the verification digs. Another interesting point is because we were keeping we being USACE and the stakeholders, were keeping the blind seeds completely 100% blind from Parsons, they felt the need to bury their own QC seeds. 48 seeds were queued on the Metal Mapper list, and 24 seeds were queued on the TemTads list. All of these ended up being placed on the TOI list. This gave the processor real-time confidence in his processing results and gave the stakeholders that much more added confidence in the results of the pilot study. So here's the size, a closer look at the size chart I was mentioning. Visually, we can summarize these seeds by looking at what we're currently calling confusion matrices. These are new to the industry, and we're still working on the presentation of this data, but I believe they do a good job of depicting the size we predicted versus the size of the actual seed. For the pilot study, we only had groups of small, medium, and large. If we look at the first row, depicted by the black arrow, we see that there were 85 small seeds. In this case, the small seeds were the small ISO, industry standard object, schedule 80, and 37 millimeters. I believe we had three different types of 37 buried out there during the pilot study. The analyst correctly predicted 82 of them to be small, and they were small, and incorrectly predicted 3 as medium. This should tell us we're pretty good at differentiating something like a 37 from a 60, but more importantly, and for verification purposes, we do not have something small like a 37 predicted to be something large like a 105 or 155. If we had, we may have had to call into question the entire inversion modeling process. Another way to look at it is if we look at the first column of Metal Mapper data, it shows the analyst correctly predicted 82 of the small seeds, are small TOI, and incorrectly predicted 2 small size seeds to be medium. This also suggests we have a high confidence in the inversion process, even with the 2 wrong predictions, because we expect this when the signal to noise gets lower, which in this case, these were the deeper seeds buried with medium ISOs at 52, 55, 70, and 66 centimeters. I want to emphasize again, though, that the important thing is we're still correctly identifying them as TOI, and again, that we never had a large item predicted to be small. Here's an interesting item that shows we're not always as smart as we think we are, or more specifically, I'm not always as smart as I think I am. By request of DTSC, we buried an item that was not expected at Camp Beale. Not only was it not expected at the site, but at no point had the 2.75-inch warhead ever been used anywhere at Beale. We thought the 275 would be a good representation of a medium-sized ISO based on their length, but because of their thicker walls, most of the 275-inch warheads came out as large. The one that came out as medium actually only had two usable curves, so the size prediction was a little off. So moving on, we're to the final step, the verification of the digging. This concept is new to the industry, and the concept is still being developed, but I'd like to share where we currently are. In order to develop a verification process, we need to look at our classification flowchart and recognize where the decision boundaries flow. It's at those boundaries we need to test our classifier and verify our selection process is accurate. Some questions we might ask about our boundaries are, did we maybe miss something deep? Did we miss something shallow? Did we miss something close to our library match? So our first step is to look at our flow chart. I know none of us like it, but it depicts pretty well our QC and decision points. This coincidentally also depicts our first mistake in project development planning. We thought we were being smart by using the 75-centimeter line spacing, but it meant we had to lower our threshold to find a 37-millimeter at 1 foot. This means we had a lot of anomalies very close to the noise and had to develop a process to identify when all of the data, the EM61 data, the metal mapper and TEMTADS, all of it, were telling us, hey, you've got something really small or you've got geology. By collecting higher quality data to start with, we probably could have avoided much of this scenario and ultimately saved some money. Another example is all of the non-TOI near the decision metric point for the library match. In other words, was our classification scheme too aggressive and we missed something close? So in this case, we have the bottom half of our flow chart. You'll see that the cutoff points for the library items were on the three-curve match, we had a 0.575. We had a 0.7 match for the two-curve metric and a 0.8 match for the one-curve match. If all of those were successful, it ended up on the dig list. So what we need to test is the non-TOI beyond that. So our theory and our proposal is to go a little further along the rock curve and dig the items between 0.57 and 575, 0.68 and 0.7, and it appears I have an error here. It should be 0.75 and 0.8. In other words, let's not waste time digging unnecessary digs. We're steering away from what has become an industry standard of random sampling, and we're moving to a much smarter physics-based approach. Rather than wasting time digging unnecessary digs, let's focus our time, energy, and money on digging the most likely TOI, or in this case, most likely UXO. This verification plan is still ongoing, but you can see the approximate numbers we were proposing. Because we used two different instruments to develop two separate dig lists, we felt it necessary to keep the verification dig list separated by instrument as well. We will use the verification digs along with all of the TOI to assess other metrics for predicted shape and size, as well as predict location and depth, all of which we've already gone through looking at the seed results. So on to the money. Almost all of these are the real costs. The detection survey costs are rough numbers, but are close to what ESTCP paid. The exciting takeaway from this slide is if you compare the advanced classification costs with Metal Mapper compared to if we had dug all of them, 6,363 anomalies, just using an assumption of $100 per dig, this results in a 54% cost increase, so we're saving that money over time. If you move on to TEMTADS, this actually results in a 23% increase if we were to dig all of the anomalies versus what we paid for the advanced classification. So as I had mentioned earlier, we chose to select targets at 0.75 centimeter line spacing as opposed to half meter. So what if we had chosen half meter instead? Well, we would have increased our upfront workload by about 33%. This is the additional transect lines in the EM61 survey. But this would have allowed us to stay with the 5.2 millivolt threshold. So instead of 341 targets or flags per acre at the 4.5 millivolt threshold, we would have had 205 flags per acre. This results in less time hunting for the source, fewer anomalies, and the number of non-TOI needed for verification goes down, all with approximately the same number on the TOI list. So the key takeaway is pay for good data upfront, and you'll save money and headaches in the long run. In this case, approximately $200,000 in additional money could have been saved from the original, from what we actually paid in the Metal Mapper classification project. This would have been a 37% decrease in project costs when compared to everything we put into it originally. To put it another way, anywhere this technology may be used, the EM61 data should be higher quality as well. This is not to say this excludes the use of existing data, and there may be applicable uses for existing data, but higher quality makes everybody's job easier and saves money in the long run as we move forward in this industry. So to end, a special thanks to all the key team players. There are many more that helped that deserve special thanks as well, but these are the key people. For those of you that have intently listened all the way through, you may have noticed the talk was titled Pilot Study for Contracting and Use of Advanced Classification. The bulk of this presentation was geared towards the use rather than contracting, but that is in part because we are still developing a final report. The final report will include an after-action report with lessons learned.
Not boring at all, John. Excellent. I think a lot of us are tickled to see that we are starting to dip our toes into the contracting waters to see how we can move these technologies into contracting and move some of those lessons, you know, from the demonstration studies into the contracting realm. So no, I think this is a great step. Excellent step. We do have a couple of questions here. Hang on one second. Let me pull my filter back up. And we have time that I think that we can field these. So since all of the seed items were detected and correctly classified, do you know if DTSC has changed their opinion that we might now have a UXO-free site in their pilot study area?
Well, that's an interesting question. We haven't discussed this, but I think realistically we need to keep open the possibility. Well, and if you go to the full CERCLA process, never do we have a UXO-free site when we have known munitions releases. We're still dependent on the detection survey out here, and the pilot study was only, well, it was anticipated to be 50 acres. It ended up being about 25 acres that's a very small part of the MRS. So I think a lot more work needs to be done into this particular site before we can walk away with a proven UXO-free site. But we're definitely moving that direction.
Gotcha. Good answer. Yes, it looks like we're starting to build a pretty preponderance of evidence to give us some good confidence in these technologies and processes. Good. Do you know if there are any other sites or states that are looking at this?
Well, there's several other sites in California that make sense to use this technology, and we're definitely in the pre-planning phases for that. There are a couple of ongoing sites out there. I'm not up to date on all of the happenings, but one I'm particularly knowledgeable about is the West Mesa site outside of Albuquerque. And that is another project that is being contracted by the Corps and is going down the advanced classification route. They have just finished seeding down there, and they are currently collecting the EM61 data. So I'm guessing they're about 6 to 12 months behind this project in terms of results.
I see. Okay. How do we determine the ideal detection survey spacing, and what spacing would you recommend using on future detection surveys at Camp Bill?
That's also a good question. This was determined because I should have had a figure in here, but as you're moving in 100% coverage, you're overlapping the sensor. So the idea is to have the item of interest pass over the center of coil, the center of the EM61 coil, as closely as possible. This will result in the highest response possible for the instrument. So for half meter, that increases the opportunity for it to cross in the middle. With 0.75, you have to worry about a 37 millimeter at the near the edge of the coil, which is a lower millivolt response. So my personal opinion, and this is not on behalf of the Corps or DTSC or the public good, but it can't feel particularly some of the odd geology that keeps getting brought up is due to near-surface bedrock. And so I think a large part of that site is not, you aren't going to find munitions very deep, probably in the top 6 inches. So we may have been able to avoid this whole scenario if we had a better grasp of bedrock distribution.
Okay. How close could targets be selected in this study and still be considered a unique target? And, you know, within size of Metal Mapper.
I guess that could be asking two different questions, so I'll rephrase it with how close to the center of the coil does a target have to be classified? And demonstration results have shown that the target of interest or whatever the anomaly is should be within about 40 centimeters of the center of the coil to properly classify it. Another way to phrase that question, if I understood it correctly, is how many targets underneath the sensor can you accurately classify? And recent demonstration results have shown that you can fairly easily get up to 5 with the current inversion schemes.
Okay,
answered my question.
Well, I think that's how I was interpreting it also. It's really kind of the resolution, within the footprint of the sensor. So, okay, good. Well, I'll tell you what, that's all of the questions that we've come in on, that have come in from the audience on your particular presentation. John, very much appreciate it. Good job with it. I think you delivered it well and answered a lot of questions. We still have a couple of minutes, and I don't want to start the next presentation until it is actually scheduled in case someone is dialing in specifically for this presentation. So we'll take a very brief, just a couple of minute break, let people stretch their legs for just a second. Okay, I think it's time for our next presentation to start, and our speaker for this presentation is Ms. Elise Goggin. Elise is a geophysicist with the Corps of Engineers, our Huntsville Center, and Elise has been very active in munitions projects and with the advanced classification. I think Elise is definitely one of our up-and-coming stars. So, Elise, wrap it up for us.
All right. Well, thanks, Dwayne. I hope there's still a few people out there sticking around to listen to me. So far, the focus of these presentations has primarily been on the use of classification for removal actions. But if any of you are like me, the majority of my work right now is actually in the remedial investigation phase of the CERCLA process. So what I'm going to discuss today is the use of classification for characterizing the nature of MET contamination on a site. All right, so the focus of my talk today is going to be the demonstration at Camp Ellis. Camp Ellis is kind of in the northwestern part of Illinois, and this is really the first implementation of an idea that's been floating around for about 2 years now, and the overall concept is to use the advanced classification technology to learn something about all the pieces of metal on the site so we can make smarter decisions about what we dig. The idea is that we should be able to reduce the number of digs while still gathering info about all the targets, and that's what Andy likes to refer to as the fingerprint for all the pieces of metal on the site. Ultimately, the goal of this study was to reach the same conclusions as far as the characterization of the site as the traditional RI did. It looks like my slides are a little out of order, so I'm going to jump forward one here. But this was a team effort between the contractor that was awarded the RIFS contract, and that was URS, and then also the Corps of Engineers. URS selected grid locations for their RI based on previous data that was available at the site. They then collected EM61 data over grids and transects and characterized the site based on digging a high percentage of anomalies from the EM61 data. They also collected the metal mapper data over select targets in a select number of grids on the site. And they did the initial processing of that data and then handed it off to me. I then continued to process the data and requested ground truth or intrusive investigation of specific targets. TCP demonstration was done at this site, and URS was one of the demonstrators at that for that ESTCP demonstration. And I'll show you whereabouts that was in a couple of slides here. So to give you a summary of the remedial investigation, the former Camp Ellis Military Reservation was actually realigned to one MRF, but it's composed of about 43 potential areas of interest. Not all of these are MET contaminated. Many are just MC contaminated or potentially contaminated. About 13 have the potential for MET contamination, and we focused on 7 of these areas. These 7 areas were selected based on data needs, terrain, and available anomaly densities in those sites. The areas are listed here below, and you can see that a removal action was actually performed in one of the areas, and that was just a partial removal action, but 2 M1 anti-tank mines were found in that area. We also had the advantage of having 100% geophysically mapped data in a few of those areas as well. Overall, we collected about 11 acres of grid coverage, and we collected metal mapper data over about 1,100 targets. The main targets of interest on the site were rockets, rifle grenades, hand grenades, and anti-tank mines, but some of the areas were pretty open-ended, and we wanted to make sure that we were looking for any potential hazards on the site. So let me give you a brief walkthrough of the areas we focused on for the demo. Here we have Area A. And this is where the ESTCP demo was carried out. And it was in this general area right here. What we're looking at in this figure, the pink lines are where ECA data was collected, and the yellow boxes indicate anomaly locations. You can see that the ESPCP demo was done in the highest density area of this target. The blue and orange squares were the grids selected by URS to investigate for the RI. You can see the data that we used for the metal, for the classification portion of this demonstration over to the right here. And the red dots represent the targets where Metal Mapper data was collected. So this is Area E. Once again, a lot of previous data collected at this site. There were a lot of grids planned here. You can see, the once again, the blue and orange squares. However, only one of them had a sufficient number of anomalies in it, and that was underneath all of these yellow boxes, which were anomalies located during the ECA. So the characterization of this area is actually based off a single grid, and that's seen to the right. Here we have Area G, and there was several grids collected and a good number of anomalies seen to the right. Area I was one of the areas that was 100% mapped in a previous contract, and you can see we were able to select, or URS was able to select grid locations in high, medium, and low density areas. So we were able to get a good look at all of the anomalies in this specific site. Area M, this was where the removal action was. You can see the two anti-tank mines found here. Unfortunately, as often happens on flood sites, we had rights of entry issues here, and we're only able to obtain rights of entries for this parcel here. So we ended up collecting about half of this field here, and those are the results to the right there. We only had about 19 metal mapper targets for this area. Area P, another rights of entry dilemma. We were only able to gain rights of entry for this small portion. So the only conclusions we can form are based on this area, and we had one grid designated for that area. The data can be seen to the right there. Area Q, 100% mapped as well. So we knew where to expect the anomaly densities, and the grids were selected as shown to the right. So let's look at these classification strategies. I used three different strategies to determine the nature in each of these areas. I think these were touched on by many of the previous presenters. I'm going to step through each of them and try to give you a brief explanation of what I mean by clustering or self-match, the library match, and then feature space sampling. But it's important to remember that this was not a removal action, so you're not going to see any complicated decision matrix like you did in John's presentation. You know, we're looking for areas of concentrated munitions use. So the goal isn't to find every piece of mech on the site. The goal is to find the problem areas. Now, this adds another potential difficulty to the problem. We need to identify frag or fragmentation and other evidence mech. So we're not necessarily looking for axial symmetric targets. So first up was clustering. And I think Kevin had some nice figures showing clustering on both Pole Mountain and Beale. And the idea behind clustering is to match the target database to itself to find out who looks like me. The difference, I think, between Kevin's work and my own was that I was using a commercially available software, Geosoft's Oasis Montage, and currently there's no easy way to do this process. There's no easy way to see the top matches just due to the way the databases treat the arrays of the library match. I believe Black Tusk has their own software that does a much better job of that at the current moment. But the good news is new tools are coming. I believe the next version of Geosoft should have tools available to do this kind of clustering analysis. So the results of my clustering efforts were not as great as I'd hoped. I did come up with several very small clusters, you know, 2 to 3 items, But the only large and sizable cluster I had was in Area A, and that had over 40 targets. None of these had a very good match to anything in my library. So that was, I felt like it was a good find. This is the cluster, and if you remember the image Kevin showed, this is a pretty nice-looking cluster. We see the primary polarizability curves and the secondary polarizability curves. Secondary polarizability curves down here. And these are both showing the same cluster. They each have six targets on each panel there. To give you an idea of how good that cluster actually is, these are the rifle grenade seeds on site. So definitely not clustering as well as this unknown symmetric item. And these were, there was some variability in the types of rifle grenades that probably had something to do with this, but in general, not the greatest clustering there. So after pulling out those clusters, went ahead and did the typical library match. Now I used a library from Fort Sill because they had similar munitions or similar targets of interest. They had the rockets, rifle grenades, hand grenades, mines. They also had 40-millimeter grenades, which I ended up removing because you're going to pull out way too much clutter if you're looking for things that small, similar to the 20-millimeter problem that was discussed earlier. I also used the Fort Sill data. And the idea behind this is that it included native frag and MD from the site. And since the munitions were similar, I was hoping to be able to pull out fragments or munitions debris from Ellis based on library matches to the SIL data. It's not shown on this slide, but I also did use the standard Metal Mapper library with items larger than a 37-millimeter. Just to catch any other types of munitions that may have been out there. Decision rules on the right, once again, not as complicated as ones you've seen previously, but they're designed to locate most mech and MD-like objects. So I just used 3-curve and 2-curve matches and took the most conservative answer. So on to feature space sampling, and this really worked in coordination with the previous two strategies. So after giving all the targets an initial label from the library match and then also pulling out that large cluster, I sampled the site based on features that could be defined by the data. Those features include size, decay, symmetry, depth, and location. And the general idea is that similar things will exist in the same general areas of a feature space. So here's the size decay feature space that you've seen before. All the squares in the feature space are the targets of interest, and the red squares are the ones for which ground truth or intrusive investigations were requested. The basic idea was to sample over 15% of each colored bin. The colored bins you can see in the pastel colors in the background, those were 6 general bins selected for this data set. When selecting these, I placed a priority on sampling other features, which I'll get to in the next slide. I also placed a priority on matches to frag and munitions debris, and I added strong matches to the library after the seed items were verified. And I'll explain that a bit more in a second. So here's the other features that I was discussing. What we're looking at here is the total number of targets on the site and the range of values for those targets for axial symmetry, plate symmetry, and depth. You can see the colored crosses represent the targets that, since I also ensured that digs were spread out geographically, the plots for each individual area are sampled in the same manner. I'm missing a slide. All right, we'll skip that slide. On to ground truth. Now, remember when I say ground truth, I really mean intrusive investigations. That word ground truth gets thrown around in the demonstration world, but in reality, it's a dig, no dig situation. So the ground truth was actually requested in a couple of phases, but to sum up the overall intent of the intrusive requests from the three strategies, I focused on, again, matches to frag, because that was really important to pull those fragments out, if possible, to indicate areas where high explosive munitions could have been used. Matches to MD, so that would be rocket motors, warheads, etc. I wanted to find out what that cluster in Area A was. I needed to sample library matches to MEC near my threshold to ensure that I didn't need to lower that. I also, as Herb mentioned, it's important to dig symmetric items that don't match your library. And then after I verified my seeds, I then wanted to dig the good matches to library items to ensure that there was no native mech out there on the site. And then I did sample each bin within, now this says the size decay feature space, but it really was a size decay symmetry depth and position feature space. That's just too hard to show on one image. So now I'm going to show you the results of my intrusive requests. First of all, I didn't find any frag. What we're seeing here is a couple of curves that matched really well to sill fragmentation. And they had over 97% matches, and they both ended up being cultural debris. And that was the case all around. Every item I suspected or predicted could have been frag was just cultural debris or clutter. I did find native MD, munitions debris, and this was in Area A. Here's a couple of examples. This is a rocket motor and a rocket warhead. You can see their curves up here, and they were correctly classified as such. So that was a success. That cluster in Area A actually ended up being MD. It was initially classified as cultural debris, but then it was reclassified as they were ballistic weight bars from practice 2.36-inch rockets. So the clustering strategy successfully identified munitions debris that was not in my library. I did find mech on the site. You see pictured here an M4 landmine with a live fuse. Interestingly enough, I did not classify it as mech. This specific type of landmine was not in my library. It was classified as a disk shroud. It was placed on the dig list because of its size and decay, and also its plate-like symmetry. It was very large, very thick, one of a few items that fell into its specific size decay group, and obviously very plate-like in the symmetry. And you can see the curve over here. It's almost looks spherical if you know what you're looking at with those curves, but the data came out to show that it was plate-like. So to sum up the characterization results after tallying all the ground truth, you can see here URS's results and the core's results. The core results were prepared before the URS results were made known to us. And we came to the same conclusions on all seven areas. Area A was a practice 2.36-inch rocket range, but no other mech hazards. M, we found that practice landmine with a live fuse, so there was a mech hazard there. Everywhere else, we found nothing except cultural debris or clutter. Except for Area G, they did find one small arms cartridge. And I'd like to caveat this by saying I did a direct comparison of what was found in the grids that were shared between the two different demonstrations. But if you'll notice, the dig columns, URS dug a substantial amount more than we did. And another thing to point out is that although I only dug 6 munition debris items, I was able to label another 50 or so for free, basically. I did not have to dig those to know that they were munitions debris. So that's the benefit of getting those fingerprints of all the of the pieces of metal on the site. Now, this is an interesting image here. And if you look at the left side of the pie chart, you can easily see that the number of digs was much fewer for the classification process than it was for the traditional characterization. When you get over to the right, it kind of depends if you're a cup half full or a cup half empty kind of guy or gal. You know, when Herb Nelson looked at this, the cup was half empty, and he said, well, you know, you still dug 82% cultural debris. But the response to that is we were chasing frag that wasn't there. And so in doing so, we did increase the percentage of cultural debris. Now, if you look at it as the cup is half full, we came to the same exact percentages of items on the site, so we characterized the site in the same manner as the traditional characterization, and we got the same idea about what was out there with digging, 55% fewer anomalies. So I like to think of it as the cup half full method. In conclusion, sampling based on a combination of library matches and features of modeled targets produced the same conclusions as digging. This process allowed me to identify neck and munitions debris that wasn't in my library, which I think is a key thing to point out, especially on flood sites. We all know that flood sites tend to throw surprises our way, and this process accounted for those. Lastly, frag is very difficult, if not impossible, to differentiate for cultural debris, and I think that is even more true on this site due to the types of munitions. Rockets, rifle grenades, hand grenades, they're all very thin-walled and difficult to classify. Their fragmentation is also going to be thin-walled, and it's going to be very difficult to differentiate from clutter on the site. If, however, you did have a site with thicker-walled munitions, maybe mortars or large projectiles, I feel like the fragmentation may cluster better, and it may be easier to differentiate from clutter on a site. So I think that this idea is still open, and another demonstration could be useful to determine if this would work for different munitions. But all in all, I think it was a success. We were able to come to the same conclusions based on fewer digs, and we learned a lot more about all the pieces of metal on the site than we would have if we would have just had the EN61 data for those pieces of metal. So that's all I have for you today. I'll give it back to you, Duane.
Very good. Thank you, Elise. And, you know, I know that the RI phase is going to it's going to constitute a large percentage of our programs for a number of years to come. So I was glad to see a presentation that, you know, illustrated some applicability to specifically related to Elise's presentation. And then we'll move into our Q&A session that'll be open for, you know, any of the material that we've covered today. So Elise, first question that we received from the audience was, you know, what were the anomaly accounts used to classify the areas as low, medium, or high density?
I was just using those in a generic term. I do not know the specific rationale URS used to classify those as high, medium, or low density, but it would be based on each individual area. I think in some of those images it was pretty easy to see where it was high density, a relative high density, a relative medium density, and a relative low density. But that would be the specific thresholds would be specific to whatever site you're working on, and it's going to be different depending on the number of or the background values that you're getting on the site.
Got it. So it'll be really MRS specific and what the project team looks at regarding the data.
Right.
Okay. Does this process cost more than just digging everything?
You know, for this, I haven't done a thorough cost analysis, and I don't know if it would be fair at this point, because during my processing, I was learning along the way and trying to develop something that could work. So it wasn't an accurate representation of how it would happen in a production situation. So I can't really answer that question right now as to would it be more cost effective.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Well, Elise, those were the questions that we have that we received specific to your presentation that rolled in, and very much appreciate your time and effort putting it together for us. And so now I think we're going to go ahead and move into our open discussion, our Q&A period. So we have a few questions that we did not get a chance to get to during the actual presentations. And then if anybody in the audience has additional questions that they would like to ask, now's the time to do that. And the first question that popped up, and this, Herb, this was during your presentation, and it was when you had the slide that illustrated the, it was color-coded. You had the red area, it was the chart, the table, had the red area of items to dig, the yellow area that were your maybe areas, and then the green area that were the let's leave it in the ground material. And so the question was, Herb, on this, on the dig, no dig line, who decides where that line falls?
Well, in our current demonstrations, we're allowing each analyst to draw that line for themselves. And I didn't show you a lot of examples, but John showed you some and Tom showed you a few. The analysts are getting very good at that. Obviously, in a real remediation, that's a site team call. The analysts will provide their best judgment probably on the way in, but the site team will have to decide how conservative or not they want to be.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Appreciate that. I think this other question probably falls in your wheelhouse also, Herb, although I think any number of our speakers could probably answer it also. How will buried UXO that is not intact and possibly contains energetic material, how will that meet selection criteria for intrusive investigation?
That's a great question, and that obviously comes up a lot. The project at Massachusetts Military Reservation, and that the objectives there are not an explosive hazard objective, but a groundwater contamination hazard. So anything that's split open, a low water that has some HE in it, they're worried about it. Even if it's not contained, they're worried about it because it would be a groundwater source. So we were very successful there at finding halves and thirds of rounds, some of which had some energy material in them. Mostly they just had mud in them. But, of course, you can't tell that from above the ground. So I think we've gotten a lot of data, and I'm going to just make this number up, but certainly a third of a round can be detected and correctly classified.
Okay. Very good. Let's see. Tom, I believe that this question came in relative to your presentation, and it was, how would you classify site difficulty? You know, do you mean, you know, the anticipated target of interest depth and size, or are there other factors that that contribute?
I'm sorry. I had two audios going at once, and they were conflicting, and so I missed the crux of your question.
Gotcha. Okay. No problem. No worries. How would you classify site difficulty? You know, do you mean the anticipated TOI depth and size, or are there other factors that that play into that?
Well, certainly the extent of on-site noise will contribute, but smaller targets, deeper targets, are the harder targets in general. But it, you know, again, there's a really a site-specific element that gets into that. You know, if as we talked about before, when earlier with the question, a lot of magnetic soil will make things more difficult in general, but all things being equal, size and depth kind of are the trade-off.
Okay. Kevin, I'm gonna throw the ball to you here for just a minute. In your presentation, you one of your slides, you know, you stated that two of the ISOs were missed. Were there any UXO missed? And what's the implication of missing an ISO but getting all of the UXO?
Yeah, there were no UXO missed. I guess the implication for the ISO, I mean, I think it's important because that ISO is chosen for a reason, and that's that it's similar in size to a target of interest for that site, which was the 37 millimeter. So I think, you know, while ultimately there's not as much of a hazard if you leave an ISO in the ground versus a UXO. I think in this case it led us to understand why that was missed, and then it sort of modified a strategy such that nothing of that size will be left behind. So I think they are important, and you really have to be able to detect all of them reliably.
Very good.
Dwayne, this is Andy.
On
that last question, one of our speakers, Herb, would also like to speak or give a response. So I'm going to ask Herb to also give his give a response to that question.
Okay, Herb.
Well, Dwayne, I just wanted to remind everyone that in the old days when we started thinking about this GSV process rather than GPOs, we came up with these ISOs, the 40 Schedule 40, relatively thinner wall pipes. It's perfect surrogates for 37 millimeters, but that was only looking through the eyes of an EM61. It turns out that the walls are thinner in those Schedule 40 pipes, and so the signal decays off faster. And that really was an issue at Cambeal, the site that Kevin just talked about. It turns out that the ISOs were more difficult to classify correctly than the 37s were. Hence, he missed a couple of the I, or his analyst missed a couple of the ISOs and not the 37s. That's what really gave us the clue that we needed. We were doing ourselves a disservice, and so that's when we changed to these Schedule 80 pipes, thicker walls, much, much more closely to advanced sensors, mimic the response of a 37. And John Jackson made the point that in his secondary work at Cambeal, they use these Schedule 80 pipes with much more success.
That's good. That makes perfect sense. Can you discuss the decay size library? Is there one or are there many? How are they obtained?
That question is for Elise, and it's for the talk that she just gave on her one of the methods that she used. So, Elise, that question is for you.
I'm not sure. Maybe there was some confusion. There's no decay size library. The library is basically the full polarizability curves for known items. The size and decay are calculated from those polarizability curves. So the size decay feature plot is just an easy way to show two of the features that you can pull out from that data. So I'm not sure if I got that question, or if I understood your question correctly. But there is a standard Metal Mapper or TimTad library that comes with your installation of Geosoft. And that has the full polarizability curves for several different types of munitions.
Yes, I believe you answered that. That's how I would have interpreted the question also. Herb, got another question for you. Will ESTCP, will it continue to support the advanced classification technologies we talked about today, or will it look for new classification technologies? Are you worn out on this yet? Are you going to be fishing about for new stuff?
Well, that's something that we're actually working on internally. At the end of this classification program, we don't intend to turn off completely terrestrial stuff, but we're going to mostly declare victory. If some great new idea comes out there, we would certainly be open to demonstrating it. I think most of our attention is going to move to underwater munitions at the end of this program, sort of in fiscal 15 and 16. Just like in CERTIP, the research half of this, we've done almost no more land-based stuff. We're just finishing up the projects we have ongoing, and we're turning our attention to underwater munitions.
Very good. Awesome. Nice. So, yeah, you're feeling pretty good about the the Star Trek tricorder. Now you're going to move it underwater, huh?
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm not feeling so good about that, but we're, you know, we're in the research stage of that.
Excellent. Okay. Elise, another question for you. Do you think that there are advantages to using classification for characterization?
I think there could be. I think it still needs to be looked at a little bit more. This site, like I said, it did not have sites really to characterize it. Well, it did, but it didn't have sites that had fragmentation on it. And I think that would be critical to verify that you could pull out that fragmentation if it was on a site. So Ellis, it was a great demonstration to show that we could verify that there was no fragmentation or no HE hazard there. But I think it only looked at maybe half the problem. So I think it still needs some work before we can really answer that question, if that was a potential remedial action you were considering on your site.
Okay, very good. Well, you know, that's in a way kind of a segue into the next question, and I think that this may be for you, Elise, or possibly even for John's material, since he talked some about contracting. Can we obtain any scopes of work that have been developed for classification projects?
I'll give that one to you, John.
I would say that we will have a pretty good template by the end of this next phase, phase two. So by end of fiscal year 13, beginning of fiscal year 14. But I could turn over that question to Andy as well.
Thank you much, John. I will back up what John just said and say, yes, I would expect that we'll have a very good template at the completion of the work we've started at Camp Beale. And I can add that we are starting to look at collaborating with ESTCP to also address this issue, or this topic, not issue, this topic. So I would expect that if all goes to plan, we're just in the early stages now of planning this kind of demonstration, but we are planning a demonstration focused on going through the contracting process and learning what we can learn from that as well, in collaboration with the STCP, and I would expect that that would come to conclusion in the FY14, early FY15 timeframe.
Very good. Okay, I believe that we've actually cleared the question list that we had from the audience, and so with that, okay, I see. Yeah, it just popped up. We do have another question, which was, what would you recommend for an FS alternative analysis? One alternative with traditional thresholds versus another alternative using classification. And good grief, Andy, I'm gonna throw that one to you.
Okay, very good. So I need to very quickly look at the question because I was busy, passing along to you. So if I understand correctly, the question they're asking is, what would they expect to see in an FS with advanced classification? To that, I would say definitely I would expect to see a separate alternative where this technology is used, if for no other reason than to show the cost differences, which is an important component in the FS analysis of using this technology over current technology. I think that answers the question.
Okay. Yep. Makes sense to me. All right. Well, with that, since I don't see any other questions queuing up right now, I'm going to wrap it up here and then turn it over to Gene for a few closing words on the mechanics of the evaluation and everything following up and registering for future classes or future webinars. But, you know, one of the things that I really wanted to mention, various they volunteered for this. You know, it's not within their traditional job duties to do this sort of thing. And so very much want to express our gratitude and appreciation for Maureen Sullivan, for Herb Nelson, as always, Tom Bell, Kevin Kingdon, John Jackson, Elise Goggin. Big, huge webinar clap for all of y'all. We very much appreciate your time in doing that. And then with that, I'm just going to encourage everybody, once again, if you have ideas for future topics, please let us know what those might be. Just drop me an email or give me a call. We'll see if we can get the future webinars scheduled. And everybody also sign up for any of the webinars that we currently have on the schedule. And then we do have the archives, as we've mentioned earlier. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Gene. Gene, I was going to ask, do you have the numbers for how many people participated in today's webinar?
Yes, I do. We had over 270 individuals who joined us from actually all over the world for today's session. And I do expect that number to go slightly up as I check with a few other people that we didn't check in electronically. We had a great turnout today.
Okay, excellent.
So with that, go ahead.
Well, let me interrupt real briefly, I guess. I should have really kind of thrown it to Andy here before I got to you, Gene. Andy, did you have anything that you wanted to close with?
I did not. You captured everything, Dwayne. So, again, my thanks to everyone for taking the time to listen in, and certainly a big thank you to all the presenters who helped make this a success.
Excellent. Okay, Gene. It's yours.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. I'm going to go ahead and walk everybody through a couple of closing reminders. Again, if you thought that this training or this session was interesting and you found it to be valuable, we offer technical sessions like this through the Cleanup Information Network almost on a daily basis. I'd encourage you to visit us at cluin.org, or you can even find us and connect with us through popular social and professional networking sites like Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter. The other thing I wanted to point out before we close out today's session, some of the most common questions that we get are, where can I get a copy of the presentation materials? And again, that's available on the seminar homepage, but you can also find it off the seminar homepage on another area called Additional Resources. So sometimes when there's additional items, other websites, other documents, more than just the PowerPoint slides, we'll collect that all together and place it on the Additional Resources page. That, too, is hyperlinked on the seminar homepage. You'll find that and the other related websites, again, on the right side of your screen under the related URLs window. Another important link I want to point you guys to is a brief feedback form. We would ask that you take just a moment or two to fill that out. I do read each and every one of the responses that goes up there, and that's how we can continue to improve our online deliveries and make sure we continue to offer free online technical training. So we thank everyone in advance for taking a moment to fill out that form. If you participated with multiple individuals at your location, each person can fill out their own feedback form. Once you submit your feedback, a link will pop up on the final screen that will allow another person to sit down and fill out their own form. If you don't have time to fill the form out now, don't worry. That hyperlink is also available on the seminar homepage and is active from this point forward. So if you're actually watching the recorded version of today's session, you can also submit feedback based on your replay of the archive. A lot of times we get asked for questions about CEUs or credits or professional development hours. We don't actually offer those type of certificates through Cluin. However, a lot of our participants can still earn credit anyway. If you take or save your registration email along with a copy of the materials that were presented, again, available on the homepage, and then actually submit feedback and check a box on that feedback form, we can at least send you a confirmation email that verifies you submitted feedback after the live delivery. And if you take that confirmation email, you can couple that with the other materials and oftentimes actually earn credit from your accrediting institution for participating. So we encourage you to go ahead and submit feedback again to request that confirmation email. If you don't receive that email, please make sure you filled out your feedback form correctly. Many times people mistype their own email address. You can fill the form out multiple times if you need to. You may also want to check your spam filters or junk mail. Sometimes the confirmation messages get trapped there. Today's session was recorded and will be archived. It usually takes us about a week or so to post those. So again, I just wanted to remind everybody that you will automatically get an email as soon as that next seminar is available. And we will be hosting the next part of the workshop again coming up on May 30th, where the Army Corps and their Military Munition Support Services group will explore non-circular regulatory framework. Again, I want to echo everyone's thanks for those of you who were able to join us today.